passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Howdy, folks. I hope you all are having a pleasant Sunday. It's pretty nice down here in the swamps. I think it's about 75 degrees out. Pretty warm. I got a little news I want to get out this morning. I am closing down a mad look at reality. Unless somebody out there would like to take over the reins of the show. The show has run 14 years. I have too much going. I myself am not healthy, and my wife isn't healthy. And it's just getting too hard to do all of it. So I'm going to either shut down the show, or somebody could take it over if they want. And have the bragging rights of having a show that's been on so long. But get a hold of me if you want to do that. I'm going to go ahead and start playing archives until somebody takes these spots. But it's been great. I just need the time. Thank you all.
It's passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming. And it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not
giving up. Revolution. Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Howdy, folks. I hope you all are having a pleasant Sunday. It's pretty nice down here in the swamps. I think it's about 75 degrees out. Pretty warm. I got a little news I want to get out this morning. I am closing down a Mad Look at Reality. Unless somebody out there would like to take over the reins of the show. The show has run 14 years. I have too much going. I myself am not healthy, and my wife isn't healthy. And it's just getting too hard to do all of it. So I'm going to either shut down the show, or somebody could take it over if they want. And have the bragging rights of having a show that's been on so long. But get a hold of me if you want to do that. I'm going to go ahead and start playing archives until somebody takes these spots. But it's been great.
Passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming. And it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. Sunday. This is. Sunny out there. Yeah, like in the 70s now, it's supposed to get into the 80s. So it would be nice. Video I want to play for you. What did you think? Hopefully. It's time travel possible. How it goes. It is. We can travel back in time and stop. We're in the Middle East. Here we go.
It's a cold, moonless night with a mist that hangs heavy in the air. As you turn to cross the road, fog swallows both the sound and headlights of the oncoming car. You see it too late and brace yourself for impact. Then, out of nowhere, an elderly stranger shoves you out of harm's way, is hit by the car, and ends up in a heap on the tarmac. Their life ends as yours is saved. Later, a police officer hands you an envelope found in the pocket of the deceased. It is addressed to you. You open this envelope and find a note with two words scribbled on it. It simply reads, "Study physics." Whoever wrote this note saved your life at the expense of theirs, so it only seems fair you follow their advice. Decades later, you become a much celebrated physics professor. Your specialist subject, Albert Einstein's theories of relativity. You've always had a hunch that time travel is possible, and one day, finally, you crack it. And the world's very first time machine is set, buzzing before you. Only then does the penny drop. How had you never realized before? You now have the power to go anywhere and anywhen, but you know exactly what you have to do. You take the letter you've kept all these years out of its frame on the wall, place it back inside its original envelope, and put the envelope in your pocket. Stepping into your time machine, you set the controls to take you back to a cold, moonless, misty night. Arriving just in time to push your younger self out of the path of the onrushing car. You die on the roadside. It seems simple enough. But the real joy of time travel stories like this one comes once you begin to scratch beneath the surface and some incredibly profound questions begin to emerge. First of all, who wrote the letter? The older version of you simply takes the letter they'd already been given as a teenager back in time. The letter is a seemingly creatorless entity stuck in a time loop. This is the bootstrap paradox. Secondly, do these time loops keep on repeating? You save your teenage self, so they grow up to travel back in time to save their teenage self, who grows up to travel back in time, and so on. You are stuck in a relentless cycle of living and dying. But the letter isn't. Does it just keep getting older and more worn and tattered? This is the restoration paradox. And whose idea was it to study physics anyway? The notion seems to appear out of nowhere, a thought with no origin. This is the ex nihilo paradox. And if events like this can actually happen, then it also appears you have no free will, no choices in life. You were always going to invent the time machine and had absolutely no option to do otherwise. It had to happen, had always happened. If you don't invent a time machine, then you can't save your teenage self, and you yourself would therefore die as a teenager. There is something in your future that's firmly fixed. This is the predestination paradox. And finally, what if you change your mind? Unfortunately, for your older self, this is not an option. You can't get cold feet when you arrive and let the younger you get hit by the car. How could you be there to have second thoughts in the first place? This is the auto-infanticide paradox. It is impossible to kill a younger version of you, even through the act of not doing something. And so, not quite such a simple story. Welcome to the weird and wonderful world of time travel. But of course, traveling freely through time is impossible, you might say. You can't simply visit yesterday or rush headlong through millennia. And yet, this too is not quite so straightforward. Despite its myriad impracticalities, there are slivers of possibility lurking at the edge of physics, temporal loopholes lying just out of reach. And so, the question arises, if time travel were to be possible, just how could we do it? In 2021, a researcher at Portsmouth University calculated there are about 6 times 10 to the power of 80 bits of information in the observable universe. That's a 6 followed by 80 zeros. Information is incredibly valuable, and data brokers are collecting yours all the time. And that is where Incogni comes in, our sponsor today. They reach out to data brokers and help take your data off the market. You see, your data is being sold online without you even knowing about it, and even though you can reach out personally and ask for it to be removed, it could take years to do it manually. Luckily, Incogni have a fully automated system to do it for you, protecting you from data breaches that are becoming more and more common. In 2021 alone, they rose by 68%. Nobody likes being called or emailed by a stranger who knows your name and home address, so give Incogni a try to help protect your employment history, shopping habits, even the names of your relatives. This is the data that these brokers collect, and if it leaks, it leaves you at risk of fraud. So protect your privacy by following the link in the description. The first 100 people to use the code UNIVERSE will get 60% off Incogni. Thanks to Incogni for supporting educational content on YouTube. The sun beats down as the distinctive whooping barks of howler monkeys echo around the humid swamps. The current in the muddy, winding river is so strong that you don't even have to paddle your canoe. You just sit back and take in the sights and sounds as you're carried along. Jack Finney, arguably one of the finest proponents of time travel fiction, compared our experience of time to a river like this one. It seems like we're relentlessly ferried downstream from the past to the future. We have no need to propel ourselves, but slowing down, speeding up, or turning around and heading back upstream doesn't seem possible either. But what happens to the parts of the river that we've left behind? Or in other words, where does yesterday go? It certainly seems as if it just disappears. Yet making the same argument about an actual river would seem ludicrous. You're unlikely to accept that the riverbed is torn up and mysteriously vanishes just because you've disappeared around the next bend. The upstream parts of the river are still there, even if you aren't. In the same way, it seems as if tomorrow isn't real until it is, that somehow it magically appears once the curtain falls on today. But that would be like new water springing up to make the river of time longer only once you approach. Where would it come from? And so, over the years, scientists have revealed that time really is like that river, with its length already laid out in its entirety, from its source high in the foothills of the Big Bang to its estuary at the universe's eventual demise. The past, present, and future existing alongside one another. Your great-great-great-grandchildren every bit as real as you are now. Your great-great-great-grandparents still alive and well, frolicking in the swells upstream in the vast river of time. Philosophers know this idea as eternalism. It's the opposite of presentism, which argues that only now exists and that the past is gone and the future yet to emerge. Debates between eternalist and presentist philosophers have raged since the days of ancient Greece. Indeed, the 4th century philosopher St. Augustine compared the present to a knife's edge, straddling the perceived past and an imagined future. But to a physicist, eternalism is known as the block universe theory and is based on Albert Einstein's much-lauded general relativity, one of the most successful theories in the history of science. In 1905, Einstein publishes the special theory of relativity. It does away with Isaac Newton's notion of absolute time. There is no universal clock that everyone can use to agree on when something happens. Instead, as the name suggests, time is relative. Depending on how they move through space, one observer could see event A happen before event B, while another sees event B occur before event A. Both observers are equally correct. An event in your past could be in someone else's future. This is yet another reason why all our yesterdays cannot simply vanish. How can they, when the events they contain might form part of somebody else's tomorrows? As well as this, special relativity cemented the fact that space and time are not completely distinct from one another. In 1908, Hermann Minkowski develops Einstein's work and properly unites space and time once and for all. He says that moving through space affects how you measure time, because the three dimensions of space and one of time are actually woven together into a single fabric that he called space-time. But how do we know that space and time are actually bundled up together into the space-time that the block universe is made of? Proof would eventually come in tests of Einstein's general theory of relativity, which he presented to the world in 1915. Back in the 1840s, astronomers had harnessed Newtonian gravity to discover an entirely new planet. Using Newton's equations to predict the future path of Uranus, they had found that it appeared to deviate from that path. The French astronomer Urbain Le Verrier pored over the equations for months, searching for an answer. Was Newtonian gravity wrong after all? Not quite. Le Verrier suggested that an unseen, more distant planet pulls on Uranus and affects its orbit. If correct, Newton's laws of gravity would be vindicated, and in 1846, Neptune was found. Despite this success, and although he didn't know it yet, Le Verrier was about to hammer the first nail into Newtonian gravity's coffin. Planets don't have circular orbits, but slightly changing elliptical ones, with the Sun offset from the center. Newtonian physics claimed that these slightly changing orbits was due to the gravitational pull of the other planets. And Newton's equations were correct in their predictions for all of them, except one, Mercury. Le Verrier realized this in 1859, and the search began for another new planet. But no such world was ever found. Instead, the answer came from Einstein. On the 18th of November 1915, he wrote a letter to the German mathematician David Hilbert. "Today I am presenting a paper in which I derive out of general relativity the perihelion motion of Mercury, discovered by Le Verrier. No gravitation theory had achieved this until now." Imagine the fabric of space-time as the surface of a trampoline. If you place something heavy in the center, it will sag in the middle. Likewise, the presence of a massive object like the Sun creates a dip in the fabric of space-time. Physicists call this a gravity well. Einstein was arguing that there is no Newtonian gravitational pull at all. It is merely a mirage. As the innermost planet, Mercury moves more deeply into the Sun's gravity well than its neighbors. The deeper it goes, the more the local space-time becomes curved, and it's this increased curvature that causes Mercury's orbit to change. For all the other planets, the curvature is subtle enough that Newtonian gravity gives the same answer. Only in the extreme gravitational environment that Mercury inhabits does Newtonian gravity show itself for what it really is, a good approximation. Gravity is not a pull. It's the result of curved space-time. Since then, astronomers have tested this idea in myriad ways, from solar eclipses to swirling black holes and rippling gravitational waves. And in every experiment, space-time passes with flying colors. Our entire cosmos of past, present, and future, merely a four-dimensional block of malleable space-time that just sits there. A supernatural being that could somehow look upon it from the outside world would clearly see yesterday, today, and tomorrow, happily coexisting. But where did this all come from? As with everything else, scientists believe that the Big Bang birthed all of space-time. In other words, all of space and all of time. The regions of time we refer to as the past, the present, and the future are all there together in their entirety. and so it's as easy for two people to exist then and now as they do here and there. They can be separated by centuries of time, just as they can be separated by kilometers of distance. Any object within this block universe can be given four coordinates. Three spatial to say exactly where it is, and one temporal to say exactly when it is. Imagine that an object's location in the block is marked by a dot. Even the dot of a physically stationary object moves because its time coordinate is constantly changing as second ticks after second, and today relentlessly becomes tomorrow. Join all the dots belonging to one particle, and you have a line that maps out its path through the block universe. A world line. You are nothing but a collection of particle world lines woven together, a knot in space-time, shedding and absorbing new world lines as you move towards the day the knot that is you undoes itself, or is undone. All the actions you will ever take, from what you'll have for breakfast every day, to if and who you'll marry, and the houses and jobs you'll flip between, are all entirely mapped out. You can't deviate from your journey any more than a train can deviate from its tracks. In this way, the block universe is like a book. The beginning, the middle, and the end are already written and unchangeable. Every choice you think you're making is actually pre-written, and so one that you are always going to make. A character caught in a love triangle on page 150 may be unaware that it gets resolved 50 pages later, but resolved it will be, and in the way it was always going to be. And this is why our time traveler from the opening story had to invent the time machine. An older version of them had already indelibly appeared on an earlier page. Their world lines eventually looped back round to intersect with themselves at a previous point. But can this really happen? Can you travel to the seemingly long-distant past, or indeed, the far-flung future? If over then is no different to over there, it seems that the door to time travel is well and truly open. In a distant corner of the universe, a gargantuan supermassive black hole is holding sway over an entire galaxy. Its intense gravity is pulling, stretching, and ripping up whole solar systems. Hot gas and dust whirl around it as its huge magnetic field spins up and spits out shrapnel into the void. Among this debris is a tiny subatomic bullet, a proton, which races across the cosmos as close to the speed of light as it's practically possible to get. It has 100 quintillion times more energy than an ordinary particle of light, and after traveling over a billion light years, it slams into Earth's atmosphere with 21 million times the energy of collisions inside the famed Large Hadron Collider at CERN. It is so energetic that to this day, astronomers know it as the Oh My God particle. An example of an ultra-high-energy cosmic ray, it is a reminder that the Earth sits in a celestial shooting gallery, and when rays like this one strike our atmosphere, the impact is so violent that it bursts into an invisible fireworks display of subatomic particles. Pions, muons, and neutrinos erupt and cascade down to the ground. In fact, cosmic rays are so plentiful that they give you an annual dose of radiation equivalent to 3 chest x-rays. And for one Italian physicist, cosmic rays became an obsession. His groundbreaking work on the muons created by cosmic rays, producing some of the first evidence that time travel to the future is not only possible, but commonplace. And his name was Bruno Rossi. Rossi is behind the wheel of an old bus, snaking along the highest road in the world, where pine trees compete with snow-capped mountains to reach the sky. Eventually, he arrives at the place he's driven over 1,000 miles from Chicago to reach, Echo Lake. Nestled high up in the Mount Evans wilderness of Colorado, part of the world-famous Rocky Mountains, it sits almost 2,300 meters above sea level. Up in the mountains, Rossi is measuring the muons created by cosmic rays. Muons are unstable particles, and so they quickly break down or decay. Physicists call the time it takes for half of a group of muons to make this change their half-life. It is just 1.56 millionths of a second. But Rossi's measurements reveal something curious. Far more muons are reaching the ground than there should be. Even though the muons are traveling at more than 98% of the speed of light, over 15 half-lives should still elapse by the time they make it down to Echo Lake, with each successive half-life removing 50% of the remaining muon population, just 0.1% should reach Rossi. And so how come he is able to detect significantly more than that? The remarkable answer was that the muons were time-traveling into our future. Einstein's special theory of relativity says that you can think of anything moving through space-time as having a budget equal to the speed of light. The more of that budget you spend on moving fast through space, the less you spend on time. As the muons are traveling at close to the speed of light, considerably less time passes for them than for Rossi. From their perspective, fewer half-lives have elapsed, and so there simply hasn't been enough time for 99.9% of them to decay. This effect is called relativistic time dilation, and when Rossi factored it in, exactly the right number of muons reached the ground. But you may ask, does this really count as time travel? Imagine instead that you are the muon, but instead of traveling from the upper atmosphere to Echo Lake, you travel on a big loop around the universe at the same 98% of the speed of light and return home 25 years older. Those of us left on Earth will have been spending less of our space-time budget on speed than you, and so it will cost us more in time. But to us, you have spent your budget differently, foregoing time to travel through space. 25 years may have passed for you while you were gone, but 125 have elapsed on Earth. You have skipped forward a whole century. Indeed, such a journey could mess with the normal generational order of family relationships, as is poignantly explored in the short story Memories of My Mother by Ken Liu. And so time travel to the future is more than possible. We just have to accelerate humans to close to light speed. That is far from straightforward, however, because the faster you travel, the more energy you have. Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared tells us that energy and mass are interchangeable, so if you gain energy, you also gain mass. In other words, the faster you travel, the heavier you get to an outside observer. A person traveling at 99.99% of the speed of light would weigh almost 2 tons, or about the same as a rhino. And accelerating them to that speed would require as much energy as everyone on Earth currently uses in 3 months. Understandably, we are very far from pulling that off, but even today, time dilation leads to some bizarre consequences. Take Mark and Scott Kelly, both former NASA astronauts who also happen to be twins. Mark was born 6 minutes before his brother. However, Scott has spent about 10 times longer in space, 520 days to Mark's 54 days. During these extra days, Scott was whizzing through space-time faster than his brother, spending more of his budget on speed and less on time. In other words, more time has passed for Mark than for Scott. Mark may have started out life 6 minutes older than his twin, but he is now 6 minutes and 5 milliseconds older. Had Scott been traveling as fast as a muon instead, their age gap would have widened to nearly 6.5 years, despite initially being born on the same day. And as if that weren't enough, there is another, entirely separate form of experimentally verified time dilation, a second way to time travel into the future. Picture a clock, except this clock works differently to any you've seen hanging on a wall. It is simply made of 2 horizontal mirrors. A beam of light bounces between the 2 mirrors, and every time the light hits a mirror, the clock ticks. Let's imagine you have 2 identical copies of this clock. You set them running before taking one of them deep inside a gravity well, like the ones explored in the last section. Space-time is more curved inside a gravity well, and so the space-time between the clock's mirrors will also be curved. The beam of light will have no option but to follow this longer, curved path. In other words, the clock will now tick less frequently than the clock you've left behind far from the gravity well. Bring them back together, and more time will have elapsed on the clock that did not encounter the gravity well. But how can this be used to time travel into the future? Well, go and enter a deep gravity well and then return to Earth. More time will have passed on Earth than for you. You could hop forward a century, just as you did by traveling at close to the speed of light. However, to achieve a genuinely significant amount of time travel using this method, you'll need a very deep gravity well indeed, one far bigger than the Sun's. A supermassive black hole should do the trick as long as you're careful not to get sucked in. And just such a scenario was used as a key plot point in the film Interstellar, suggested by the famous physicist Kip Thorne. But Earth also creates its own gravity well in space-time. When Rossi drove his bus up the winding road to Mount Evans, he was moving further out of this well. In other words, he moved from a region where space-time was more curved to a region where it was less curved. He aged at a fractionally faster rate up the mountain than he did down the mountain. This difference is so tiny that a human is never going to notice, but atomic clocks do. The best are such good timekeepers that they are accurate to within a 15 billionth of a second every year. If you sync up two atomic clocks on the same shelf of a laboratory and then place them on shelves of different heights, they will noticeably drift out of time. Indeed, in 2022, physicists measured this gravitational time dilation using ultra-precise atomic clocks placed just a millimeter apart. And finally, you're likely to rely heavily on time dilation, probably without even realizing it. GPS has become an indispensable part of modern life for many of us. Our phones and cars can tell where they are on Earth thanks to an armada of satellites swarming around the planet. These satellites send out time-stamped signals, and the quicker you receive one, the nearer you must be to that satellite. In order to achieve this, the satellites carry atomic clocks, which are subject to both forms of time dilation. They are both moving through space-time faster than us, and sit further outside Earth's gravity well. The time on the clocks has to be artificially altered in order to account for the fact that they are moving through time at a different rate to us. These experiments leave physicists in little doubt that time travel to the future is possible. It is established scientific fact. But what about heading in the other direction? Is it possible to head upstream and visit the past? It is 2011. Barack Obama is president, Prince William and Kate Middleton are newlyweds, and NASA's iconic space shuttle lands for the last time. In September, physicists make a shock announcement, one that rocks the scientific establishment. They seem to have observed particles called neutrinos traveling faster than the speed of light. If true, it would shatter one of the holiest doctrines in physics and open the door to backwards time travel. The bold claim comes from the OPERA experiment, buried deep under Italy's Gran Sasso mountain. Designed to detect neutrinos fired 730 kilometers through the Earth from CERN near Geneva in Switzerland, making that journey at the speed of light would take a mere 2.4 milliseconds. Yet some of the neutrinos appear to be taking 16 nanoseconds less than that. In other words, they seem to have gotten there traveling faster than the speed of light. Einstein's special theory of relativity says that the speed of light is an impenetrable barrier. The faster you travel, the heavier you get. The heavier you get, the more energy it takes to increase your speed further. Eventually, there comes a point when it requires an infinite amount of energy to increase your speed, so you can't. And that cutoff point is the speed of light. While a massless particle of light can travel at light speed, anything with mass cannot reach light speed, let alone exceed it. And so, inevitably, within a year, the neutrino mystery was solved. The experimental equipment was faulty. The neutrinos weren't superluminal, after all. The initial finding caused such a stir because traveling faster than light would allow you to travel backwards in time. And the story of why starts with a young Dutchman by the name of Willem Jacob van Stockum. In 1937, van Stockum publishes a paper with the seemingly dull title of The Gravitational Field of a Distribution of Particles Rotating About an Axis of Symmetry. While mundane in name, it was revolutionary in nature, for it showed that Einstein's equations allowed closed time-like curves in space-time. Our world lines usually stretch from the past to the future, but a closed time-like curve is a world line that doubles back on itself, closing a loop as it intersects the line at a previous point. A pensioner following such world lines could revisit the moment of their birth, or even save their teenage self from a car accident. Von Stockum had demonstrated that, at least on paper, there is nothing in the general theory of relativity to forbid backwards time travel. Except that at first glance it seems bending your future world line into a closed time-like curve requires you to travel faster than the speed of light, to travel outside of what is known as your light cone. If your world line is the singular path that you actually take through the block universe, then your light cone represents all the paths that it would have been at least possible for you to take. Imagine that you are stationary in space, your world line moving forwards in a straight line through time only. What are your options for where you can go in the future? Well, assuming that we stick with special relativity, you are confined by the fact that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, which is approximately 300,000 kilometers per second. 1 second from now, you cannot be more than 300,000 kilometers away from where you are currently. Yet you could be up to 600,000 kilometers away in 2 seconds, and 900,000 kilometers in 3. The further ahead in time you go, the bigger the region of space-time that your future world line is allowed to be in becomes. That's why it's called a light cone. The edges of the cone represent the furthest a beam of light can be from where it starts at any given point in space-time. And so unless you can travel faster than a beam of light, you are trapped within the same light cone. Meaning that in order to loop your future world line around, so that it intersects with itself at an earlier point, you would have to leave your light cone. In other words, time travel to the past appears impossible unless you can move faster than the speed of light. But there is another way to do it. If you constantly tilt your light cone so that your closed time-like curve to yesterday is always within it. And to do this, you would need to encounter space-time with an incredibly high amount of curvature. In 1974, the American physicist Frank Tipler explored this very situation, specifically what would happen to a cylinder containing at least 10 times the mass of the Sun and rotating along its longest axis. He showed that following a precise spiraling trajectory around this cylinder would warp your local space-time in such a way that your light cone would gradually tilt backwards. And as your world line must be somewhere within the cone, you would then be ferried from the present to the past. Visiting a Tipler cylinder and then journeying back to Earth would see you arrive before you left in the first place. However, in order to tackle the fiendishly difficult mathematics, Tipler had to assume that the cylinder is infinitely long. He couldn't conclusively prove that a shorter one would do the trick. It would also have to rotate billions of times a minute to warp space-time enough, hardly features of a practical time machine. Then, in the 1990s, Stephen Hawking added another layer of complexity. He argued that getting a Tipler cylinder that isn't infinitely long to work would also require huge amounts of negative energy. And it is here that quantum mechanics enters our story. One of the pillars of modern physics, alongside Einstein's general theory of relativity, it deals with the subatomic world. According to quantum physics, even empty space isn't truly empty. Pairs of so-called virtual particles are popping in and out of existence all the time. Energy is borrowed from the vacuum to create them, taking the local energy just below zero in the same way that your bank balance drops into negative territory when you go into the overdraft and borrow money from the bank. Just like the bank, however, the universe eventually wants its money back. So negative energy is out there, but it's limited to tiny regions of space for fleetingly short amounts of time. As a result, closed time-like curves may exist in the subatomic realm, but creating a time loop big enough for a human to travel along to revisit the past seems an entirely different proposition. But there may be another way to achieve the same thing, a way to cheat the sacrosanct rule of the speed of light as the cosmic speed limit. A wormhole. In 1985, the celebrated astronomer, author, and TV presenter Carl Sagan published a novel called Contact. In it, an advanced alien civilization reaches out to humanity with the design of a device capable of sending a single person across the vast chasm of space to the star Vega. Taking into account that nothing can go faster than light, this 25 light-year journey should take an extremely long time. So instead, Sagan wanted a way to get his heroine there far faster, but without invoking faster-than-light travel. Even though the book is finished, Sagan phones his friend Kip Thorne for advice. Sagan overnights the manuscript to Thorne, who reads it in the car the next day on his way to his daughter's graduation. A few quick calculations follow, and Thorne has the answer. What Sagan needed in his story is a wormhole. Imagine space-time as a sheet of paper, with the Earth at one end and Vega at the other. Now, instead of traveling the length of the paper, you fold the paper in half. After all, we know that space-time can be curved and bent. Earth and Vega are now right on top of each other. Hop the gap between them and you get there in no time at all. From the outside, it would look like you've got there by traveling faster than the speed of light. But at no point did you actually break through that sacred barrier. And so it follows that a wormhole can not only transport you to a different part of space, but it can also send you back in time. Let's say the wormhole to Vega is already set up. First, you need to attach the Earth mouth of the wormhole to a rocket and drag it round on a loop through the universe at close to the speed of light. As the wormhole has been spending more of its space-time budget on speed, less time will have elapsed from its perspective. This means that if you jump into the wormhole upon your return to Earth, you will emerge at the other end in the past. Crucially, though, you will also be in the Vega star system. So it is backwards time travel, but not heading back into Earth's history. But there is still a way to pull that off, too. Set the wormhole up in the right way, and the time difference between its mouths will be greater than the time it will take you to return to Earth via the conventional route. You will arrive on Earth before you jumped into the wormhole in the first place. At least, that's the theory. In practice, it gets a little more complicated. Thorne realized that the gravitational pull of anything traveling through the wormhole will act to pull it shut. You would need something to help prop it open. This, again, could be negative energy, but physicists have also explored the possibility of using everything from quantum entanglement to magnetic fields. In 1985, J. Richard Gott and William Hiscox solved Einstein's equations for cosmic strings. 6 years later, Gott realized that they could also be used as a time machine. Just like spiraling around a tippler cylinder, take the right path along cosmic strings, and you could end up tilting your light cone backwards. Quantum entanglement might be another option. Physicists know how to link two particles in such a way that changing one instantly changes the other, even if you separate them by huge distances. It's as if the information about the change you've made has traveled between the particles faster than the speed of light. But it has turned out to be impossible to actually transfer data superluminally using this method. So it seems there are multiple ways you might be able to travel backwards in time without breaking the light speed barrier. But were it to be possible, what could you do about the paradoxes? Well, quantum theory might offer a solution there. The handcuffs dig into your wrists and sweat streams down your face as you stare at the table in front of you. On that table rests a glass vial of lethal gas next to a hammer on the end of a robotic arm. A robotic arm connected to a machine that is constantly measuring subatomic particles. These particles can be in one of two states, A or B, and the chance of measuring each outcome is 50-50. It's effectively a convoluted coin toss. If the outcome of the measurement is A, nothing happens. But if it is B, the hammer falls, the vial is shattered, and you die. The The machine will make 100 measurements before the people watching from the other room will allow you to leave. Your odds of survival are around 1 in a million trillion trillion. You can feel your heart pounding in your chest as the machine makes its first measurement. A. You relax slightly, only to tense up again ahead of the next measurement a few seconds later. A. Again. After the 10th A in a row, you begin to feel hopeful. Surely you can't survive this. After 99 consecutive A's, you're practically giddy. It all comes down to one final measurement. The machine clicks. A. Your captors are true to their word and unlock the handcuffs. Although you don't know it yet, your unlikely survival against seemingly impossible odds just provided proof of the many worlds' interpretation of quantum theory, with potentially important consequences for resolving time travel paradoxes. This is a human version of the famous Schrödinger's cat thought experiment. The original imagined victim was a feline in a box with the same vial of poison and hammer. Quantum physics says that instead of being in state A or state B, the particle is initially in both state A and state B at the same time, something physicists call a superposition of states. Except that means that the vial is also simultaneously unbroken and broken, and that the cat and you were both alive and dead until the point the next measurement is made. Is there something about actually making the measurement that forces the universe to finally choose one way or another? Not according to the many worlds' interpretation of quantum theory. Brainchild of physicist Hugh Everett III, it says that every time there's an event in the quantum world that has more than one outcome, all outcomes happen. At that point, the universe fractures into two copies of itself. Outcome A happens in one, outcome B in the other. Reality is therefore constantly branching off to fashion a tree of possibilities. The great river of time bifurcates into infinitely many separate streams. There are some in which you were never born, and others where you are president of the Earth. If true, making 100 measurements with the poison and hammer machine would have created 100 different branches of reality. You died in 99 of them, and survived in one. As the sole surviving copy of yourself, you marvel at your own luck. The 99 copies of yourself in the other branches, though, aren't so fortuitous. Covering a sliding scale from those who died after one measurement to those who went through the whole process only to die on the 100th. This is known as the quantum immortality experiment. There will always be a version of you that stubbornly refuses to die, no matter how many times the machine makes a measurement. In a sense, it's a game of Russian roulette that you can never lose. While physicists do not know whether this interpretation of quantum physics is the right one, the many worlds theory could help us resolve many of the paradoxes that are often associated with time travel to the past. Take, for example, the most famous paradox of all, the grandfather paradox. You use your time machine to go back and murder your grandfather as a child. However, that means he never reaches adulthood, never meets your grandmother, and so your own mother is never born. If your own mother was never born, then you weren't either, so how did you go back in time to murder your grandfather in the first place? Writers, philosophers, and scientists have come up with various ways to circumvent this issue. Stephen Hawking introduced what he called the chronology protection conjecture. It states that backwards time travel is simply impossible. The universe would act to rob you of any opportunity to go back in time. Cause and effect, sacrosanct and tightly policed. Igor Novikov mused on something similar. His eponymous self-consistency principle says that you can go back in time, but that you can't change what's already happened. If you revisit an earlier page in the book of the block universe, you cannot rewrite what is already there. Attempt to murder your younger self and you will fail. Maybe the gun jams, perhaps they sneeze and you miss. Try as you might, you could never succeed. This, of course, raises other problems, however, whether events in your future are predetermined, or even whether free will exists. Nor would Novikov's self-consistency principle work in all cases, as Barak Shoshani, Jared Wogan, and Jacob Hauser show in a series of papers published between 2020 and 2022. Imagine you have a working time machine. You also have a set of balls that are either black or white. Crucially, when two balls meet, the encounter changes their color. So a black ball becomes white and a white ball becomes black. Let's say a black ball travels through the time machine where it whacks into its past self. The encounter changes both balls to white. The collision also knocks the ball that's already time-traveled onto a path that eventually sends it through the time machine a second time. In this scenario, the exact same ball exits the exact same time machine at the exact same moment in the past, and yet it is seemingly two different colors when it does so. This peculiar paradox cannot be explained away using Novikov's self-consistency principle. But according to Shoshani, Wogan, and Hauser, it can be explained using parallel time streams, the many worlds of quantum mechanics. They argue that time travel to the past is only possible if you emerge in a different stream from the one you left. So the black ball would start in time stream A, but would emerge from the time machine in time stream B. In this alternate time stream, it's the other ball that would end up going through the time machine after the collision instead, not the one that's been through once already. The ball that emerges from the time machine the first time is a different color from the one that emerges the second time. But that's now okay, because it is no longer the same ball. This kind of extreme mental gymnastics takes some time to wrap your head around, but it does offer a potential solution to the grandfather paradox. If you enter a separate time stream when you go back in time, then you can kill the version of your grandfather there, safe in the knowledge that the version of your grandfather that's crucial to your logical existence remains alive and well in the time stream you left behind. Your free will is restored, giving you the choice to do whatever you want. It is possible to use many worlds to circumvent the bootstrap paradox as well. In our tale of the time traveler saving their teenage self, the origin of the letter wasn't clear. No one seemed to write it. But perhaps we were missing characters from our story. The version of you in time stream A could write the letter, travel back in time to time stream B, and give it to their younger self. That teenager then chooses physics, grows up to invent the time machine, and travels back in time to time stream C to give their teenage self an apparently authorless letter. So we can also explain the bootstrap paradox away, but we need three versions of you existing in three separate time streams to do so. If that seems like using a sledgehammer to crack a nut, you're not alone. It could be a shining example of just how humans can tie themselves into intellectual knots. The number of splitting branches could be infinite. As the physicist Bryce DeWitt said, every quantum transition taking place in every star, in every galaxy, in every remote corner of the universe is splitting our local world on Earth into myriad copies of itself. But John Wheeler, the very man who coined the phrase wormhole in the first place, fell out of love with the idea. I have reluctantly had to give up my support of that point of view in the end, because I'm afraid it carries too great a load of metaphysical baggage. And yet, over the years, the many worlds interpretation has gained traction with physicists and now has a growing and loyal following. An endless array of views, each a little different from the next, playing out every possible outcome of every possible event in constantly fracturing streams along the great river of time. And so, as we travel along our world lines at varying speeds within the great block universe around us, time travel to the future isn't just possible, but has already been done, and is being done every day. Of course, traveling backwards is less clear, but it seems plausible, at least on paper, with a little helping hand from the counterintuitive world of quantum mechanics. For now, we'll just have to make do with the memories of yesteryear, safe in the knowledge that the past is very much still out there. You've been watching the entire history of the universe. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.
Well, I was muted, sorry. The number is 229-299-5320. That's 229-299-5320. Let's get a conversation going. I don't like a little time travel in the morning. Just think what we could do with time travel. Uh-huh. Kind of funky, if you ask me. Get ourselves in a bunch of trouble, I think. What we'd end up doing. Everything else the government messes with. Oh, shoot. I know it's been a while since I've been live. I've been sick. I went to the aquarium in Atlanta, and it turned out to be school day. So there was like 2,000 3-foot-tall kids running around in there, and I'm sitting in a wheelchair right at their height. So it got me sick. Nick asked what I caught. I have no idea. I was sick, that's for sure. I think it was just a cold. Yeah, Surrey says children are walking test tubes. This is true. Yeah, petri dishes. So. We've been joined by Nick.
Walking bioweapons.
Yeah.
Especially after they gave him all the shots and everything.
Yeah. That's the way kids are.
Well, what did you take to fight off whatever it was you got?
Do I know?
What did you take? Did they put you on medication or anything?
No, I didn't go. It takes me damn 3 weeks to see my doctor. Hell, by the time I get in there to see him, I'm all better.
That's usually how it goes.
You know, so why bother? It makes no sense to me.
That's the VA for you, too. Yeah, I don't need your help now. I needed it 3.5 months ago.
Yeah.
That's okay. We'll take a look at you anyway. There's no point.
Well, it's too late then, my opinion.
Yeah, when I dicked my knee up last year, first thing I did, I wasn't in my home state. I was somewhere else, and I called the local VA and said, hey, man, I got to come in and have a look at this. Okay, you got to go and contact the people in Wisconsin, and then you have to contact this person up there. They have to get back to us, and then we have to bring you in for a consultation. And then it's like, you do realize I can't walk right now, right? And say, well, this is how we do it. And say, well, that's not how I'm doing it.
It's better to just go to the emergency room with them.
Well, yeah, that's what I ended up doing, and having my knee operated on through a private hospital. And when I left Oklahoma and I got back up here, I got a call from the VA down there saying, hey, we've approved your consultation. When can you come in? I said, that was 2 months ago. I'm already done with all of that. So, you know, you guys are really on the ball here. But that's the way the VA is now, right? It's all screwed up.
That they definitely are.
Now they, you know what the choice is, the choice thing that they have in the VA now?
I don't know anything about it.
Where you can get an outside doctor and the VA will still cover it.
Oh yeah, to a certain extent.
Yeah, yeah. But then here's the rub. When they screwed all that up, they send you the bill anyway. And so, wait a minute, this is not how this is supposed to work.
I don't get a bill. I got total medical, which it makes them even worse wanting to deal with me, you know?
Yeah.
Because no matter what I say, they've got to listen to it, you know?
Right. Yeah, they are. The only time they actually started getting polite with me was when they got a call from my congressman's office. Not from my congressman, because he's a dick and he's bailing out on us. But the lady that handles the veterans stuff out of his office, she called them up and I get a call. I called him back up and said, so what's happening? She said, oh, I already called them. I've talked to them. They're getting everything straightened out. And literally within a day, they were calling me up. Sir, when would you like to come in? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Anytime, sir. You make the appointment, sir. And I was just like, damn, you guys got polite real quick.
Yeah.
But
I threatened to sue him.
Oh, did you?
I said, look, if I do one little thing out of place, government's all over my ass and want to sue me.
Uh-huh.
I said, no, apparently this is what I'm going to have to do.
Yeah, especially when it comes to them getting money from you. Man, you don't cross every T and dot every I. They are, you owe us this money, and now you owe us penalties and interest because you messed up that little part right there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my wife has been dead for 15 months now. 16 months now. Their California tax franchise tax board still coming after her. It's like there's nobody to pay you guys and nobody to file anything. So I don't know what the hell they're planning on doing, but whatever.
Well, hey, I know you don't want to mess up if you're getting food stamps from them. They'll drag you through the dirt for them.
Oh, yeah. And here in Wisconsin, they got a thing.
Over $300, you know?
Yeah. Here in Wisconsin, you have to work to get your food stamps.
Well, they tried that here, but too many people would get hurt.
Yeah, I mean, when they passed it, it didn't go over well. I wasn't living here at the time when they did it, but it didn't go over well with a lot of people. But it's like, hey, you know what? You might be out of work and everything, but you're still able-bodied, so we're going to give you something to do. Which is fine. I don't see an issue with that. Maybe, you know, maybe they can find some employment out of it. Who knows?
Yeah. But hell, I do get out of this country and come back illegally.
Yeah, go down to Mexico. Just walk in and then come back across and say, hey, and get yourself one of those ID cards that they're selling at the border and say, hey, I want all my free stuff. Where's my $10,000 gift card and my free hotel room? Because that's what they're doing now. You know, we apparently don't count, you know, being American citizens and all.
Oh, look at Philadelphia. Have you seen Philadelphia?
Yeah.
It's a shithole.
Yeah, it's the land of the walking dead. Those people are so screwed up on street drugs right there. The fentanyl that's coming in and whatever else they can get their hands on. I've seen people shooting videos all over Philadelphia, and man, it literally looks like the zombie apocalypse is happening. You know, Los Angeles.
Zuma's revenge.
Yeah. you know, San Francisco and L.A. aren't much better. You know, just sidestep the needles and hope you don't put your foot in a pile of human shit on the sidewalk there while you're doing it.
Oh, that's so sad. You know.
Well, this is what happens when you let, you know, this is not, by the way, that's not by accident that any of that stuff is happening. That's all very orchestrated. I mean, remember the crack epidemic back in the 80s?
The what?
The crack epidemic. When the inner cities were getting flooded with drugs, with cocaine and crack. And
oh, crack, yeah.
Yeah, and that just tore those things apart. And then it turns out it was the CIA bringing the stuff in so they could fund the war down in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
So now you got to figure out, okay, so now they're letting all this fentanyl and stuff come in. What are they using the money for this time? Ukraine?
Oh, the color wars.
Yeah. Man, and I've seen people who are messed up on that stuff. You tell you, there's nothing left of them after a little while.
Well, I'm walking outside. I can't answer the phone when I'm out there. So, you all have to call in about 5 minutes.
You're not there to take a smoke?
Yeah, I'm going to go smoke a cigarette. We don't smoke in the house. I thought y'all left.
No, I'm still here.
No, I'm talking about my wife and
daughter.
I thought they'd done left. They come got my credit card.
I'll tell you
anyway, what. They weren't going to forget that, you know?
Yeah, of course. Honest to God, I cannot wait till the day I get mine paid off and I put it through a shredder.
Well, I don't have a credit card. I got a debit card.
Oh, yeah, I use a debit card. That's because you can't build up a interest rate on that because you're using the money that you have. But this credit card, oh, my God.
Well, I am. I figured out a way of getting credit, making it use credit. So.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you can do it, that's fine. But the way that the banks have the system set up. Okay, now, so not only do you got the IRS draining you out, you got these banks with these credit cards, man, are absolutely killing.
You take these debit cards and you get one of them magazines that sell you stuff with a magazine. Even if you don't want the damn thing, for $100, do it on payment plans. You wouldn't believe what it does to the credit rating.
It takes a couple of years.
My wife's got 897.
Oh, wow. That's huge.
That's huge. She can literally go get a vehicle with no down payment.
Huh. Yeah, when was it back in 2001? When I bought the condo out in California, I had no credit rating because I never bought anything on credit. I used cash for everything.
Well, see, if you do that, what we did is we'd buy presents, birthday presents for the boys.
Uh-huh.
And now we buy birthday presents for the girls, my granddaughters on there. And it's just, you know, 20 or 30 a month. And you don't even notice it, you know?
Yeah, well, because especially after when the COVID, all that stuff hit. And, you know, when they gave you that, what's it, like 2 months where you didn't have to pay any bills or something?
We still paid it, you know, it's still coming out.
Given the situation with me and Angelica, I had to call him up and say, look, I can't cover this. So give me the 2 months. And they said, okay, fine. We understand. That's no problem. We'll just, you know, move, slide everything down. And then in that time period, they said, oh, by the way, you didn't make any payments on your card. Your card is suspended. I'm like, wait a minute. You said I could do this. No, well, you didn't make any payments. Yeah, but you said I could. I didn't have to. Yeah, well, you didn't make any. And so they shut it off. I haven't used it for anything since. And all I'm trying, and like I said, once I get that knocked out, it's that thing is history. Because they keep telling me, well, you know, you have a 15% interest rate, and when I do the math, it's really like 30. When because the amount of, that you make payments with, and it's like the interest rate, what you're actually paying is not evening out to what they're telling you it is. So once that thing is done, going in a fire, it's getting shredded, it's just gone. I'm not getting a credit card ever again.
Yeah. Well, we had credit cards years and years ago, you know, 40 years ago. But I learned real quick and that was back when they charged to use them.
Right.
And I thought to myself, why would I want to pay somebody to use my own money?
Uh-huh. Well, that's what interest is.
That doesn't make no sense to me.
Well, that's what they.
I mean, they don't do that. They don't do that now. But when I was a teenager, you would take $20 or $30 a month, put it in your savings account, and they would pay you interest.
Yeah.
Now they charge you.
Now, if you get below a certain amount of money, they charge you a fee to keep your money. And it's like. That was like the most ridiculous damn thing I've ever seen.
Well, they peddle out 3% and 4% interest to you, and they literally, I'm not going to say how I know this, but you, if you go look for it, you'll find it too. They make roughly 21% interest.
Yeah.
So they're making money off of your money and charging you to do it.
That's the banks. That's the banks right there in a nutshell. And then they come up with all these other rules that say that money doesn't really belong to you. It's our money when you put that in the account. And
practical banking we wanna... is nothing but a fancy way of creating wealth out of nothing.
Yeah. Well, that's what the Fed does. You know, and they have to, and they're the ones who restock all the banks, and they put out so much money that they don't have. And all they're doing is making an entry into a ledger electronically or on paper. It didn't matter. The government goes, hey, we need some money. They say, how much do you need?
When you go buying gold, you better make sure it's not paper gold.
Yeah, no, never buy paper, buy metal. And then you, with gold now, you have to make sure it's not filled with tungsten instead of solid gold. But even now, because people are – the banks are buying up gold and people are trying to invest in gold, the premiums on precious metals is like through the roof. I mean,
if you brought all the gold in the world to the same spot, it would only make a cube 45 feet square.
Yep. Yeah, there's not that much of it.
No, we got a lot of it. It's just way down in the earth. We can't get to it. Most of the gold that's mined that we use is actually gold that came in from asteroids.
Oh yeah, I believe that. They've already found a couple. They found an asteroid out there. I think I read this a couple of years ago. They found an asteroid out there.
Of gold.
So full of gold. It's worth more than the damn planet, practically.
Mm-hmm.
When the GDP or the, you know, the finances of every country in the world, this thing is worth more than all of it. There's just no way to bring it here.
Oh, we have a way to bring it here. It would just take, you know, hundreds of years.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we got to. A bunch of people. We can't even get back to they supposedly got to the moon in the 1960s, and we can't go back now with the technology that we have.
I think we've been back and forth constantly the whole time.
Well, And the funny thing is, too, like, because you got Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos doing their little space things.
Yeah, well, they're the fall guy. They're the ones that's going to take the.
Well, you know. But did you ever watch any of those space shots that they do when they take on passengers and say, hey, you get the for $200,000 you can take a go up into space, and essentially it's just a rocket propelled catapult. Because all they do is just fling them in the air like a baseball, and they go, oh, look, we're up in space, and they come down 10 minutes later. It's like, no, you want to put me for $200,000, you're going to put me in space.
It should be at least an orbit, huh?
Yeah, I want to go around the planet a couple of times before I come down.
It should be like a Ferris wheel, huh? Yeah.
But not this, you know, huck me, you know, slingshot me over that mountain right there and land me in the desert. No, I don't want to do that. I want to go around a couple of times and see what's what. But
well, they're afraid you'll see what's going on.
Yeah, probably.
There's stuff out there that people just don't realize. Do you know what you see in a rainbow is only half the rainbow? If you're up in the sky in a plane, it's a circle.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know that. I've seen that before.
But everybody thinks it's a rainbow, and it's not.
No, you can, if you look at the halo effect, when you know, if you get one of those foggy days or something or whatever's up in the air, and you get that halo effect from the moon or from the sun, that's what exactly, that's more like what a rainbow should look like, that circle. That big giant circle.
Yeah, the ice particles.
But because you're
talking about.
Yeah, but you're so close to the Earth. You're standing right on the surface of the Earth. You're not gonna. You don't get to see the whole.
Yeah, you don't see it. It's optical illusion when you're standing on the Earth. But I've seen some pictures of it recently. I thought it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, because I used to do that when I was a kid. When I'd go over to my grandma's house, and she lived right on the South River in Massachusetts, and where her house was located, they had a seawall holding the thing up. And we used to go take the hose and put it on mist and spray it over the side of the seawall. It did make that circle for the rainbow. It didn't make just the little top part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. I never found a pot of gold either, damn it.
That's what I was saying. That's why I said it, because it's kind of impossible to see where it actually touches, you know?
Well, I've had people tell me they've actually driven through the rainbow and freaked them out because of the different color spectrum. I've never been able to get to one to see the end of it because the thing keeps on moving.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, with all the
ever done.
And with all the stuff that's out there, makes, you know, if you could actually get up there and really take a good look and see what you know with your own eyes, see what's going on, it'd probably be amazed at what our governments are not telling us, what our scientists aren't telling us.
We just learned about what's called a sprite. In the last 10 years or so.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of them, but remind me again what they are.
We have no clue what they are.
Okay.
We just know it happens. You know, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of guesses of what they are. But actually knowing, that's a different story.
Well, I think it would be a lot of fun to go up there and see how many... Not just the communication satellites, but see how many Defense Department satellites are up there and what their payloads are.
We're tracking a little over 10,000 pieces of trash from the size of a nut bolt to the size of a refrigerator.
Yeah.
It's just trash.
Yeah, that's the stuff that hasn't even fallen down.
Yeah, well, so, when they say they're waiting on a launch window,
They're not waiting on the good weather. They're waiting on an area that hasn't got trash in it.
Yeah, that's coming at them at 17,000 miles an hour.
Yeah. But they're not telling you that. They're, you know, they'll let you think whatever.
Yeah, we got to wait for the weather to clear up. Why? It's not that bad. Yeah, well, you know, we can't go into details. You know, it's kind of top secret. You know, or the, my other favorite one that they always say when they can't tell you something, it's a matter of national security, so we can't tell you anything. Do you remember this old TV show in the 80s with Andy Griffith in it where he built his own spaceship and went up to the moon to salvage all the crap that was left up there?
Well, it was in orbit, but yeah, I remember it.
Yeah.
It was a movie of the week.
Well, they turned it into a TV series.
I didn't know
it didn't last very long because, you know, it really wasn't all that good, but I just thought it was funny.
Oh, man, do you know how much gold is in them satellites up there?
Oh, yeah, lots.
Platinum and plutonium?
Lots. I mean, you grab a couple of those things out of the sky and you'd be well off for a little while.
If you ever see an IBM computer that stands up with the big wheels on it,
mm-hmm.
You know, tape reels?
Yeah, the old
ones. You
better
grab that sucker. There's $1,000 worth of gold in that bitch.
Now, they got these videos where these guys will take computer boards, you know, circuit boards and all of that stuff, and they'll drop it into acid. And the acid will eat away everything except for the gold and the silver and whatever else. You know. So they wind up with this little pile of metal at the bottom of the bowl when they're done.
Hmm.
So, you know, people, you know, you can throw away all your computer parts all you want to, but you might want to try scraping some of that stuff off before you chuck it in the trash.
Well, you're not supposed to throw it in the trash. You're supposed to dispose of them properly. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, but let's deal with the reality of the situation. People throw them in the trash. It's like even on the cockpit windows of our fighter jets, they're coated with gold.
Yeah, why? Anything that's got a red tin and glass, gold is used.
Yeah. Well, they have to with the jets and the military stuff because that's the way they explained it to me was if these guys are heading into wherever and the nuclear bomb goes off, they won't get blinded. Or
gold is the best radiation barrier we have too. Yes,
gold
that's why
lead.
You see that gold film on the landers and stuff. That's the reason. It's not to make them look free.
And those Mylar bags.
Yeah, I mean, you think they're Mylar bags, and they're actually...
Well, that's what they tell you that they are.
It only has to be a cell or two thick in order to stop radiation better than anything else we got.
Yeah. Well, that was always one of the questions that people had with taking that capsules to the moon. And I've seen some of these NASA people get really upset at the question is, how did you make it past the Van Allen belts? Well, and they don't want to answer.
Well, one thing is, how big is the Van Allen belt?
Nobody
will answer that question.
I know
how
it's
thick
out,
is it?
I know it's out about 3,000. I know it's out about 3,000 miles, but I couldn't tell you how big
does
it is.
Does it take 10 seconds to travel through it, or does it take an hour and a half?
Yeah, or does it never stop? You know, what is it?
Yeah, you know, so...
Because apparently the radiation...
But nobody's ever... I've never been able to find a comprehensive answer to that.
No, but, you know, and it, because they don't answer it, it makes you kind of makes you think that they don't know the answer to it either. I mean, I don't see Neil deGrasse Tyson going on TV giving out any details about it.
Well, he'll talk about now, if they're surrounded by that gold, what difference would it make?
It shouldn't make any difference.
Right. That was my point when I mentioned the gold.
Yeah, exactly. But it'd be interesting to see if some of these multi-gazillionaire guys can actually pull off a trip back to the moon again and see what happens.
Well, I think it's scheduled, and in order to bring it about to the masses. Now, they're going to have scheduled failures involved in that. They have to.
Well, they still do. They've been doing that.
You're not going to do something like that without there being some kind of failures.
Well, you see that happen.
They have to make it look. They have to make it look good. Back in the 40s, the government even admitted they wanted a base on the moon and said that whoever owns the moon owns the world.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, so far, we're the only country that's got a flag planted up there, apparently.
Well, it's perfect weapons platform.
Yeah, I mean, nobody could take out your base up there. We don't have missiles that'll go that far.
Energy weapons will go that far.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're getting real good with those lately, too. I mean, it used to be when they really got into the heavy development of them, they were putting them on airplanes to knock missiles out of the sky, but they had to have all these chemicals and fuel on the plane that took up most of the airplane, and you shot that thing off for like 30 seconds and you burned everything out, and then you had to land and resupply everything up again. So that program didn't stick around very long, but apparently they had some developmental breakthroughs where they're shooting up islands from orbit and burning them to the ground. Unless you got a blue roof on your house.
Ever see that movie, Real Geniuses?
Yeah, the one with Val Kilmer in it.
Yeah. Developing a mirror.
Yeah. Oh, they had a pretty good point to it. What was the guy's name? The one who's like really smart, but he was really weird.
I don't know.
And he, while they were developing this high intensity laser weapon, he's the one who kind of made him think for a second when he told him, yeah, you got this high intensity laser with a short burst of energy and an unlimited range on it. Makes you kind of think, doesn't it? And they all just went, oh, wait a minute, what are we doing now? So, the people that are developing.
That was a reference to a Bond movie, wasn't it?
Which Bond movie?
Or to what's his name? The comedy one.
And the Pink Panther?
No.
The comedy Bond.
Mike somebody or another. Mini Me.
Oh, you're talking about Austin Powers.
Yeah. Have a shark with a laser beam hooked to his head.
Freaking sharks with freaking laser beams attached to their foreheads. Yeah, he sort of burned out that whole Austin Powers thing. And his third movie, the third one was like not that good.
I didn't even watch any of them. That's not my kind of movie.
It was funny.
I want a movie that makes you think about stuff, you know?
Yeah, but there's always room for some comedy in there, too.
What you see here on these shows in the morning, I've done listening to them. I liked it, you know, or I wouldn't have brought it.
Right. But, well, and again, go back to the DEWs. The people that develop this stuff, I mean, of course, they're, like, smart, obviously, you know. Otherwise, it wouldn't be on the projects. But did they ever think about who they're developing this stuff for?
Yeah.
You know, when Oppenheimer and Feynman and the rest of the people working on the Manhattan Project, when they developed the first atomic bombs and everything, they said, okay, now that's great that you figured out that you can do all this. Did you ever figure out whether or not you should be doing this?
Yeah. No, they don't. They think they, you know, they're scientists and they have the right to do whatever. And I don't fully agree with that myself. There should be certain things that are left.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we shouldn't do this.
Personally, I don't believe in chimeras. I don't think we should be messing with the genome in that manner.
Yeah, they've been messing around with that for a long time too.
I can see and can understand people messing with human genome, but not with the public involved. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. But that was...
If they want to become another species, let them.
Well, that's not even... Right now, they're not even trying to become a whole other species, sort of, you know, by mixing and matching DNA strands from different animals. Now their big push is for the transhumanist movement, where they're trying to merge with technology.
Well, I don't have a problem with that either. It's when they force it on you that the problem becomes...
Well, that's what they want to do.
You know? Well, see, they don't have no right to do that.
Well, yeah, but when did they ever care about that? See, that's the whole thing. That's the way these people kind of think. If you ever try to get into their headspace, is it doesn't matter what you want. It only matters what they want. And you're just in the way. And if you're not, if you can't be of some sort,
well, then they shouldn't be allowed to play.
Well, that's what I think too. But unfortunately, they dangle some cash in front of some of these so-called leaders of ours, and here you go. And it's like, fine, what do you want us to do? Okay, we're on it.
You know, I ain't got a problem with, personally, I think that at one point we'll be able, if we decide we want to go to the Caribbean for the weekend, for a week, that we go to the doctors and get a shot for temporary gills. No big deal. I don't see a problem with that. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I had to mute my mic for a second because my dog was acting up.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that, you know. But to do it and then have it permanently done, that's another story.
It's the thing too, though, is with the messing around with our DNA and all of that. At some point, it's like Plum Island. You know what Plum Island is, right?
Yeah.
The bioweapons lab up in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing ever stays contained.
No, it doesn't. Nature has a habit of getting out.
Yeah, so now if they suddenly, you know, okay, we got this experiment where we're crossing DNA strands to create a new species of human being, but we have it in the lab and it's perfectly safe. You know it's not going to stay there. Okay, then it's going to get out and it's going to start getting into everybody else, and pretty soon everybody's going to be dying.
That's what I'm saying. Now, permanent guy has lungs or gills installed permanently. Is that going to affect his children or his children's children? Who has no right? I mean, you know?
Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, that would be actually be kind of cool to have gills. You don't have to worry about breathing underwater.
Well, that's just an idea. But if all you're doing is going to go visit it twice, 2 weeks out of the year.
But.
You know, yeah, but if your job was under sea surveillance or something, you know.
Yeah. But again, these places have a very lousy track record of keeping anything contained.
And now they've got it so they can put certain lenses in humans that'll enhance their eyesights.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of scary to me. You don't know where you could be sitting 200 yards away from somebody in the dark and they can see you perfectly.
Yeah, instead of having to use night vision, they can just open their eyes. And again, it's not the technology part of it that worries me. It's the people who are controlling it.
Right.
Because, you know, they're, again, you look at the stuff that they've been doing.
You got nuclear medicine. You got nuclear medicine, and you got nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
So.
And both of them do the same thing. They pump you full of radiation, and then people can't figure out why they're getting cancer. That's okay. We can treat it with radiation. Yeah, isn't that what gave me the cancer in the first place?
Yeah, I never understood that with breasts, them checking breasts, and I wouldn't let my wife do it. You know, I said, no. I said, they suspect you of having some kind of cancer, and yet they're going to shoot you full of stuff that causes cancer?
Exactly.
I said, where is the science involved in that?
Well, especially since... every time, if you ever get cancer, the only options that they will offer you that insurance will cover is chemo and radiation. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, what about all this other stuff that's out there? Well, you're free to do that if you want to, but we're not paying for it. Because it's a business. It's it's a money-making thing. Well,
what they do with chemotherapy is they try to bring you as close to death as they can get you. And hope it kills the cancer first.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Yeah, that doesn't make no sense.
And then even if it does work, then your immune system is completely destroyed.
Completely destroyed.
So you got to take all this other medication that the insurance doesn't cover to counter all the side effects. Yeah, it's really, when you look at it from that point of view, it's really a big scam. Because even
is all about how much money they can get out of you.
Well, yeah, ever since the Rockefeller hijacked it back in 1901.
Well, Bush is the one that he allowed them to make money off it.
Well,
the moment they were allowed to start making money off it, that's when it went to hell.
Yeah, and
Rockefellers controlled it. $16 for a friggin' aspirin.
Yeah, and then all your medications that they give you are all petroleum based at that point because why? They own the oil. Hey, why don't we just try some natural medicine? No, that won't work. I've heard people talk about
because they can't patent living plant.
Yeah, well, why do you think they wouldn't let hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin be used as treatments for COVID? Because there was no money to be made in it.
Right.
So, it's all about cash.
They went from inoculations to, what was the other one? I can't think of the other one. There's three of them anyways, and before they went to giving a shot for the flu.
Of the vaccines?
Yeah. Well, a vaccine. Right? The inoculation kept you from getting the disease.
Yeah. Well, the weird thing is, I got this book about the history of vaccines and how they came to be developed and everything. And how it started was they were making healthy people sick and sometimes killing them in order to keep them from getting sick. And it all started with the cowpox. And what they would do is they would take the pus out of the cowpox from the cow and inject it into people, and then be like, okay, now you're not going to get sick. And a lot of them ended up dying. But
yeah, then they tweaked it, and the inoculation became an actual functioning product.
It did, but not anymore. I wouldn't trust a vaccine for anything at this point.
Well, not now, because they haven't made them in years. They quit that. Study.
Yeah. Now it's now vaccines are nothing more than a delivery system to stick you with whatever they want. So I do not trust medical people with my health anymore at all.
I haven't had a flu shot. I've had one my whole life. And I was lied to in order for them to give me that one.
Yeah, I don't know how many.
Buddy, I raised holy hell when I found out. I was mad. It literally looked like somebody electroshocked me all across my chest with blue.
So the vaccine lit you up?
Yeah, I mean, because he told me it wasn't. He told me it wasn't a vaccine.
Oh, and, yeah, okay.
And it just it looked like somebody had electrocuted me.
Wow.
Oh no, my arm about half dead. I couldn't do shit. I got a weird system, and I'm allergic to a lot of strange stuff that normal people can take.
Well, even like last year when they cut my knee open, when they were, you know, before you go in, they have to give you, like, sit you down and explain how everything is going to go and all that other stuff. And they're asking me, okay, do you have any questions? I said, not so much of a question, but it's more of a demand from you guys, which is, do not give me any narcotic drugs at all. I don't want them. I don't like them, and I don't want them stuck in me. Yeah. So, oh, you got an addiction problem? It's like, no, and I don't want one either.
Yeah, that trips them out, because I don't take any pain medicine.
Yeah. So when I got the report back from the hospital afterwards,
Cheetah, stop it.
They found out that they had doped me up with fentanyl as part of the anesthesia process, and I blew a gasket. I was just like, "What the hell did you guys? Didn't I just tell you not to do that?" Well, it's just standard practice now. Yeah, but again, didn't I tell you not to do that? So
once you sign that paper, it's up to doctor's discretion.
Yeah, I know. That's
a problem right there.
Yeah, and they won't do what they need to do without you signing it either.
Right.
So, I mean, even Physicians for Freedom, when I went and saw those guys, was about a year and a half ago or so. And these were guys who did not go along with the program so much. I mean, they have to keep their jobs to a certain extent and all of that. But it was like, they were like, you could tell that they were fed up with the medical system themselves. Unfortunately, that's their profession. So, you know, they got to do it to make a living. But it's like they were almost begging people to, you know, please trust us again. We really have your best interest in mind. And these guys probably did, you know, because these guys were getting in trouble for not going along with the programs. But when the stories started coming from the people in the audience about how the hospitals had killed their husbands and their wives and boyfriends or girlfriends and whatever, because of the COVID protocols and all of that. And these guys literally were hanging their heads at that point. It's like, you don't get it. You're not getting our trust back. Okay, it's impossible. It's not going to happen.
Well, I ain't never had mine.
Well, how can you after, I mean, when you're a kid and everything, you're told that these are the doctors and they're going to help you and that's all they're here for is to help you. So believe what they say. And if anything, the last 4 years has shown us that you really can't. You cannot trust this medical system that we have right now. So, and plus, again, that whole thing, that was all money-making gig too, was the whole COVID thing, and not just on the vaccine side of it, but the hospitals were making money. Like $250,000 or $300,000 if you died in that hospital and they could make it a COVID death. And they did. So, again, it's all about the money. But, and then, of course, in the...
Well, I'll tell you what. People need to come on and call in. Number is 229-299-5320. That's 229-299-5320 from Mad Painter on Skype.
Yeah, we need more voices in this conversation. I need other points of view.
The ping pong table now. It's supposed to be a round table.
Yeah, we're just bouncing them back and forth. But it really kind of makes it
being a little creative too.
It makes you wonder what kind of other experiments they're doing on us that we don't know about. So, like,
free will is an illusion. You mean you're destined to do whatever?
Well, you can only make decisions based on information that you have, and if they're giving you false information or not enough information, they're gonna steer you which way they want to go. So, I mean, and that whole propaganda that happened over the last 4 years, I mean, somebody either this morning, I think it was. And they said, you know, that whole thing was just it was a waste of and whatever, and the vaccine didn't do what it was supposed to. No. You're missing the point of everything that happened. This whole situation did exactly what it was supposed to do. The amount of data that these people got on human behavior, they have volumes of it. And they're going to adjust their agenda accordingly, because now that's just more information that they got. Okay, if we do this, people are going to react that way. If we do this, they're going to react the other way. So they learned a lot over the last 4 years about the way people are going to react. My whole reaction to the whole thing was, leave me alone. I'm not going along with the program. Thank you.
Well, I tell you, they've gotten a lot of data.
Yeah, tons. Tons of data. I mean, they're probably still sifting through a lot of it.
Oh, yeah, they ain't got it all. Yeah.
So the next big PSYOP that they're going to have, They've already got all this data from the last 4 years all factored into it, and they make something that's even more effective to get people to do what they want them to do. So I just make it very simple. I just don't trust them. I don't believe anything they say. It makes it a lot easier. But even that's that can be collated into some data that they can use. So now the big question is what yeah we hear you. And what's going to be the next big event that they're going to try to push through?
Well, I hope it's make everybody rich that has bitcoins, because the station's got a bunch of them.
Yeah, we definitely need people to send some donations in here. There's a little button at the top of the page, at the homepage, that you can push. And now you got the cryptos, too. Where's that thing? You got those three QR codes where you can send in different kinds of crypto.
We don't have that much, but we have enough that...
We
made $200 just for having them.
Well, that's something.
Yeah.
You know, or you can do snail mail. There's an address down at the bottom of the homepage that you can send off a money order or something.
Well, it helped us out with getting this new stuff up and running that Roe's doing. That's going to change things.
Is that the link over to Rumble?
Well, that's just one of them. There's going to be like, at least five or six to start. This is something that's going to revolutionize talk radio.
Good.
Not just Revolution Radio, all stations.
Right. Because I was going to do the link to Rumble last week on my show, and I couldn't figure out how to make it work. I mean, I could do this show.
Well, so you won't have to do anything other than pay the $8, and it does it automatically.
Right. Well, I mean,
You don't do nothing.
I mean, I could do, like I said, last week I could do this for Skype and I could do Rumble, but I couldn't do them both, and sync them up together. Yes, so
and you won't have that problem will be taken in turn.
Oh, yeah, good. I'm looking forward to
and
it.
And you won't even know it.
Because it'd be nice to put this stuff up on streaming live and whatever. Means I got to build a set wall behind me, though. But that's fine. So, the more we can get this stuff out there, the better. And if we can, what would be really great is when we get some of the guests on to interview and stuff, if we pop them up too in the on the screen so people can see who they are.
Well, now the host will have to be responsible for whatever's being said on that particular Rumble. It's no big deal what they say.
Right.
But, you know, on a couple of them there, they got a little thing you're not allowed to say on their platform.
Like YouTube, you mean?
Yeah, YouTube, you can't mention suicide. You say suicide, they'll block your damn video.
They take my videos down anyway. This is why I don't even put video up on Rumble anymore or on YouTube anymore. I move everything to Rumble because stuff that I put up 5 years ago, before all the COVID stuff happened, they're telling me, oh, you're spreading medical disinformation, so we're taking it down. It's like, that was up like way before any of this stuff happened. Yeah, we're taking it down. So I pretty much told YouTube to go bite me, and I'm moving
stuff
over there.
My first 5 years of videos because of YouTube.
Yeah, they're real big on censoring stuff. So that's
really mine weren't that bad. I mean, I didn't.
Mine weren't that bad either.
Now, at first I had government stuff going on. They didn't like that much.
You're not allowed to say anything bad about the government.
Oh, I had people they didn't want on. People that are wanted by them in other countries. They didn't like that too well.
That's funny. Yeah, I know. I mean, it would be great to get an interview with Julian Assange or Ed Snowden or some of these people that are just really pissed off the government. Why? Well, and why did they piss them off? Because they told the truth. They told the truth about what our government was doing.
Roberts, I can't remember his first name. They were looking for him for 7 years. And I got him to come on. And he won his case against the government and was allowed to come back.
That's funny. Did you get a phone call for that one?
Oh, man, when we were trying to set it up, they come to my house and cut the cable in two places and went to Hawk's house and cut the cable.
The feds did?
We don't know who did it.
Oh, wow.
It was just before my show when we were advertising him coming on.
Well, this tells you something. They're listening, so.
They didn't want him on. Stephen Roberts, I think. He had a show out of Philadelphia for years.
What did they want to get a hold of him for?
Stuff he said.
Yeah, but I mean, was he making threats or something?
He was telling the truth.
Yeah, and that you're not allowed to do that anymore.
No, they don't like that. The mechanic was telling the truth too, but the truths he was telling were little ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They weren't national policies and shit, you know?
Yeah, they don't.
I mean, he done a great job of what he was doing. Don't get me wrong now. But he wasn't at the scale of these other guys.
Right.
He might have got there one day.
Yeah, that's when they start coming after you. And that's why they went after Jones.
Alex, they did that. That was a slap. That was all that was, and it was on purpose.
Yeah. Well, I got a feeling it was they needed to set a precedent so they could bust Donald Trump's balls. And they're even dropping everything against him. So, you know, that whole system is the whole judicial system we have. Is really just like, we're going to sick these guys on you, take everything you have if you don't keep your mouth shut types. So, good luck with that now, because I got my ham license. So, I'm going to be talking about this stuff over those airwaves too.
Oh.
Are we in the break yet?
Huh?
Are we in the break yet? I think it's time.
We don't have a break on this show.
Oh.
Usually there's too many people to have a break.
Yeah, we need some more people to come on.
I haven't come on quite a bit recently since the beginning of the year. I've been sick and I spent, you know, a couple weeks in the hospital. I couldn't do a show. And afterwards, I was just too sick to even stay up for 2 hours, let alone four.
Yeah. It gets hard when you're not feeling up to it.
I've been fighting for my life, man.
Wow. Well, no.
Yeah, and then I got my wife. I got to take her.
Hold on. Oops. Just calling. Hello. Hold on, I can't say right in a second. I got to shut my mic off because I'm not going to put it out over the air. Hold on a second, Mad.
Remember, we are totally listener supported, so if you got a buck or two, we'd sure appreciate it. Call in at 229-299-5320. That's 229-299-5320, or a Mad Painter on Skype. That's the insane Mad, not the pissed off Mad. I hardly get pissed off. But when I do, watch out. I'm going to get my other computer set back up and see about getting us a store up and running again. But it sure won't be Zazzle.
All right, I'm back. All right, when people call you up when you're doing something else. And then when I'm sitting around doing absolutely nothing but relaxing, nobody calls. So
I don't even own a cell phone.
Oh, I do. It comes in handy sometimes.
I got no use for one.
Only the thing I got it because it does come in handy, but the thing I hate about having a cell phone is the fact that they can track you wherever you go.
Yeah.
So I have an ammo can in my car, and when I'm on the move,
I had
just drop it in there.
I had a guy on that wrote a program for that thing, for the cell phones.
Oh, yeah?
Even though they're turned off.
Oh, no, that's not listening.
There's enough ambient power in them for it to be turned on remotely.
Yeah.
And a GPS hooked.
Well, like I said, that's why I have an ammo can in my car, because I'll drop it in the ammo can, close it up, and it cuts it off.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it cuts it off because I tried to call it, and I couldn't get
Faraday
through.
Cage.
Oh, yeah, big time.
I got a wallet that way from my cards that nobody can read them out of my wallet.
Yeah. Did you get the bag or did you get an actual box?
The whole wallet's that way.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Even a motel key, you know, you can stick it in a regular wallet and just hold your wallet up there.
Uh-huh.
Can't yeah, do it don't work that way.
There you go. But, yeah, it was funny because I was telling, I think it was my sister, a little while back and said, yeah, you do know that they can listen to you on your phone even though you shut it off. What? What are you talking about? And that's old technology. That's not even the new surveillance stuff that they're coming out with.
Well, they say they've got technology now that they can make your monitor a camera.
Yeah, they can turn. I know they can turn your wireless. If you have a Wi-Fi modem in your house, they can turn. They can scan your room with the Wi-Fi system, and they can position where everybody is in the room, and even look around the corner.
Yeah, them new light bulbs that they were selling.
The LEDs.
You can literally listen in to the room.
Yeah, but good luck trying to find the old incandescent light bulbs.
I just don't see them needing that kind of power, you know. It just makes no sense.
Well, but whether or not they need it, they want it. They want eyes on everybody all the damn time. And everybody thought 1984 was like, God, that could never happen. It is happening. Yeah. It is. People are putting this stuff in their house. You got your smart TVs. You got your smart refrigerators, your smart stoves, your smart thermostats.
You look up the codes that are on your bill for your cell phone. And you're paying Homeland Security to spy on you.
Yeah, pretty much.
You are.
So. And they're building those fusion centers so that they can store all the data and so that at any given time they can go dig back 20 years and use some information against you if they want to.
Scary.
But if you go out on the street and you start taking video, especially of government officials or the police or whoever, they get mad at you and tell you you're going to get arrested for doing it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's hard to get away from the technology side of everything now because it's everywhere.
Well, it works both ways, too, though. I mean, we got to. Video of a doctor acting really pig-headed and God complex going.
What was he doing?
We ain't done anything yet until I can find another doctor for my wife.
Well, I mean, what was the doctor doing? What was the doctor doing that it was, I mean...
Kicking somebody out of the room who wanted to understand what the problem was.
Huh.
Because my wife can't remember what the doctor says.
So they kicked somebody else out. That almost sounds like, I don't know if you're familiar with the Grace Shara story. The girl that they was hospital over in Appleton ended up killing. And there's a huge lawsuit going with it. But when the parents tried to go in the room where she was, the hospital put an armed guard on her door and would not let the family in to the room.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
Yeah, I think so. You know, and they ended up treating her all kinds of stuff that they shouldn't have, and they ended up killing her.
My wife went in there with an infection in her leg. She sat there in a chair next to the examining table, and on the examining table was a cat cleaning itself.
This is in a hospital.
In a doctor's office.
In a doctor's office. Yeah, I would say you probably would want to find a different doctor. Jesus, that's funny. Yeah, why didn't you just come in and take a dump right on the table?
Well, it doesn't matter. He could have just climbed out of the kitty litter box, you know?
Oh, yeah, cats have all kinds of stuff in their claws. I mean, there's that thing called cat scratch fever. It's not just a Ted Nugent song.
It's an actual thing. Yeah.
You know, they use those claws to kill everything. They walk through crap in it. They got that the stuff in the litter box all in there. You get a good scratch, and you're going to get an infection.
When I took her to that doctor, I said, I went in there the first time, and I said, well, I'll never be back in there with you. I said, you're going to have to bring somebody else. You know, I took a disliking to her instantly.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of them are like that. But people got to also remember this: when it comes to your health, you're in charge, not the doctor. But they seemed, even the doctor seemed to forgot that stuff. Because all they got to say is, we believe this person is a danger to themselves, and they can literally have you detained. The doctors can. And I've seen them do it, too. This was at Olive View Medical in the San Fernando Valley. And some girl came in, and I guess came in with somebody else. And she was getting ready to leave, and I didn't catch the whole conversation, but they had the sheriff come over, and he was like, should I go and get her? And the doctor said, yep, go get her. And they dragged her. I mean, she was fighting the whole way in too, but they dragged her and they strapped her down and took her, put her off somewhere. So I was looking at that going, what the hell right did you have to do that? Well, she's a danger to herself right now. And it's just like, and you're a psychiatrist or a medical doctor? Which is it? But
This broad don't use a computer either.
The doctor doesn't?
Uh-uh. You got a file that's got to be 5 inches thick on my wife.
Yeah, you'd figure it'd be easier to store all that stuff digitally.
Yeah, well.
But it's good to have a paper backup in case something happens.
Can't put nothing in a computer. Don't trust them.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's always good to have a paper backup for things. I mean, it's fine to store everything electronically, but man, you get a lightning, like around here, you get a lightning strike and a power surge, you know, whoop, there goes all that. So, you know, one good EMP burst and it's like, well, there goes all that. But,
Where is everybody? Damn.
I'm going to wait.
Making me want to close this show.
Where's Wally and the rest of the survivors?
This is the longest running show at the station.
How long?
Been running for 13 years.
So this is like from the very beginning, right?
Huh?
The show was on from the beginning?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I don't know how long Wendy's been on, but she's the one who got me started on this.
Y'all are about a decade.
Yeah, we've been here for about almost 10 years.
Yeah.
Because
Willow probably knows.
Well, I remember when, because I didn't know Wendy very much at all. She was part of the neighboring assembly district in California. We were both part of the Republican Party of Los Angeles County, by the way, which is why I'm not going to ever be a Republican again, too. But we were doing joint meetings because it was easier to deal with everything in our area that way. And she just came up to me one day and just said, I need you to be on the radio with me. I'm like, well, yeah, okay, sounds like fun. Let's do it. And been on ever since.
She had her afternoon show, I believe.
When I ran into her, she was Granada Forum on Friday nights at 7. I don't know if she ever had an afternoon show. But, you know, then I put my show together because I wanted to deal with some of the stuff I wanted to deal with and just kept on going from there. So hopefully when we get this other stuff put together with Rumble, that'll just make it even better. I'm looking forward to that.
I remember.
So.
Oh, I know I'm tired. I took a nap.
Starting to fade out a little?
Yeah. I've still not got no energy.
Trying to think. Did you, I don't know, have you tried dosing up on vitamins a lot?
You got me on some vitamins, I don't know. Vitamin D, I know.
Yeah, well, that's a requirement where I live because we don't get sun all that much.
Well, I used to.
But,
yeah. Half of my work was outside, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I did that a lot in California. But in this part of the country, up where I live right now, it's like you get 3 months of warm weather. I mean, good warm weather. And the rest of the year, it's usually cloudy all the time. So, and the first year that I got here, I went and did my annual physical over at the VA, and they said, man, you've got, like, no vitamin D left in you. It's like, is that why I feel like crap? And it's like, probably. So I've come to realize that that's a requirement. You better start taking that stuff. And I do like the days when we do get the sun here.
And I don't. I should open up the curtains. Mm. I'm too lazy.
I was going to say you might want to try taking vitamin C, too.
I don't care enough for vitamin C.
Gear
never really
just
done me. I grew up in Florida in Orange Grove.
Yeah, that was always what I liked. One of the things I like. You can walk down the street in the San Fernando Valley, and somebody has some fruit hanging there. You just reach up and pick it. So you could get fresh lemons and fresh oranges, depending on what kind of tree they got.
We lived literally in an orange grove, and it was two grapefruit trees in the backyard.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah,
I'm talking about it was miles of oranges.
Well, that's what it used to be like that in, what was it, the 1930s? I want to say San Fernando Valley, that was nothing. It was orange groves. That's what it was. And you can't find orange grove in San Fernando Valley anymore. They dug everything up and put a bunch of houses in it. So you'd have to go up to where the 126 is, which is north of San Fernando Valley a little bit. Cut through that area. That's where all the oranges are. And there's a bunch out in the Inland Empire out there. You can't have an orange tree here, though, because it won't make it through the winter.
Entice them with that chunk, you know. Look, you're not going to get $250,000 out of this, you know.
What's that?
A chunk of money.
Oh, yeah.
They sell an orange grove, you know.
But I do got my fruit trees growing up here anyway. I got my apple tree, my plum tree out back, and hopefully this pear tree that I got going will start to do something here pretty quick. It made it through the winter, so that's a big plus, but it was a pretty mild winter this year anyway by comparison. So that'll be good to get some of that stuff going and get some fresh fruit and whenever I want. Plus I got the garden I got to get planted up this year.
Huh? Who's that?
What's what?
You said he left up the driveway? Or am I hearing things?
Are you asking me that question?
Yeah, I thought that's what you said.
No, I said I got to get the garden planted this year.
Oh.
I thought you were talking to somebody else there for a second.
So I got my grass cut this week, and it cost me $150.
To cut your grass?
Yeah.
Oh, you had somebody come in and do it for you?
Yeah, I'm at $150 a month, I just go buy me a fucking, do it myself.
Yeah, go buy one of those used ride-on lawnmowers and go for it. I'm not going to pay somebody to cut my grass for me unless I'm going to be out of here for a while. Because if I don't cut it, then the town comes in and hands me a $150 bill. Because they come in with weed whackers and knock the grass down and say, here you go, that was $150 worth of work. It's like, not really, but...
I didn't like it. I know that.
Well, it's any time they come out to your house to do anything, it's $150, apparently. So, make sure all that's taken care of because I don't feel like paying them any more extra money than I do already.
Yeah, they're firing it. Cutting it myself when he shows up. He's going to repair his privacy fence. Wanted permission to get on our property to do it. I says, yeah, no problem. He says, I can tear down that chain link fence. And I said, no. Well, once the chain link's down, then the house isn't the fenced in yard anymore.
Right. Yeah, I got to get up a small fence around my place so I can let the dog stay out for a while. Let them enjoy it. But I'm going to have to put a screen on the top of it because we got eagles and hawks around here, and these aren't exactly big dogs that I got. We got some wicked amount of turkey vultures around here, too. And surprisingly, those are some big birds. I mean, they were landed on the house across the street from me, and we're all up on the roof. And, you know, it was like straight out of some kind of Addams Family TV show or movie or something, watching those things walk around. But I have seen the occasional bald eagle flying around here. And I don't think they would think twice about scooping up one of my dogs. That would be just like a snack to them. A couple of Chihuahua McNuggets.
I don't see them very often, though.
Are the eagles?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, we've got quite a few of them around here.
We've got some big... red-tailed hawk.
I used to see those all the time in California. Where was I going? I was going down one of the highways here and looking up ahead. There was some roadkill in the middle of the street, probably a raccoon or something that somebody smacked, and there was an eagle munching on it. And that thing, when that thing took off, it was like, that is one big bird. What is that, 7 foot wingspan, and this thing launched itself right in front of my car, and I was just like, yeah, there's a reason I keep my dogs indoors.
Okay.
So. Yeah, Matt, you sound like you're about to nod off here in a second.
Pretty damn close, let me tell you.
All Well, if you gotta get some sleep, man, why don't you just run another video for the rest of the show?
I don't know what time it is.
It's 12:30 where I'm at, so might be 1:30 where you are.
That's an hour and a half.
Yeah.
I could throw something on. I'm breathing real heavy, too.
Yeah, I can hear it. See, I don't know if I can find anything.
I've got plenty up here.
Oh, okay.
Just they're all an hour.
That'll eat up some time.
We can stick with the time travel theme.
There you go.
I appreciate you joining me.
Hey, yeah, it's fun. It's always more fun when we got up more than just the two of us. But well, anyway,
how about history of the Mandela effect?
That's always a good one.
We'll put that on. Appreciate you joining me, today, Nick.
No sweat. It's good to come on. Good to hear you back on the show too. So.
I'm trying. Well, lost it. Here's Inner Earth Conspiracy.
This investigation is sponsored by Raycon. Hey, fellow seekers. I'm Mr. Mythos, and we're back with another episode of Inner Earth Conspiracy Theories. In the silvery blue waters of the Mediterranean Sea lies a group of islands we know as the country of Malta. Lesser known, though, is that this place
is home to
prehistoric subterranean temples over 1,000 years older than the Egyptian Great Pyramids, alongside a history of problematic archaeology and what seems to be ancient secrets worth covering up. Since their rediscovery in the late 1800s, Malta's underground temples have been plagued by strange happenings, from sudden deaths and disappearing documents, to a group of children going missing, and even a report of gigantic beings living in the deepest levels, which remain largely unexplored to this day. As one of the strangest sites on Earth, the secrets of Malta are well kept, but today we'll investigate the stories and evidence and attempt to unearth what might be lurking deep beneath the Maltese soil. But before we dive into Inner Earth, as many of you know, I do a ton of research for these videos. And to get into the zone, I love listening to classical and lo-fi music with my everyday earbuds from today's sponsor, Raycon. Starting at half the cost of other premium audio brands, Raycon's audio quality and features are quite impressive. By holding the button on the left earbud for 3 seconds, I can switch the sound profiles to turn up the bass for music, maximize clarity for audiobooks, and more. And with a 3-second hold on the right buds button, I can toggle awareness mode to let in outside sound if I need to hear something, or block it all out with noise isolation. But here's what I love most about my Raycons. They're comfortable. As a guy who listens to music for several hours at a time, I don't feel any weight at all when they're in, and their gel tips are so soft that I forget that I'm wearing them. The everyday earbuds have over 50,000 five-star reviews, so there's a good chance you'll love them too. And Raycon believes in their products so much that you're backed by an easy, free return guarantee. So if you're ready to buy these small earbuds designed for giant sound, click my link in the description or go to buyraycon.com/mythos to get 15% off your Raycon purchase. Thanks again to Raycon. It's time to tune our ears for heavy footsteps in the distance because we're about to encounter the inner earth giants beneath Malta. As ancient as its history is, Malta has long been a fertile breeding ground for mythology. Whether it's tales of both the Greek hero Odysseus and the Christian apostle Paul becoming shipwrecked here, or the country's many superstitions, such as the tendency for all the clock towers on the island to show two conflicting times, to confuse the devil and keep him from disrupting church service, folklore seems to have been built into the bedrock of these tiny islands. What we're interested in today, though, are the legends that have identified Malta as the home of giants. Normally, when people talk about the giants of Malta, they're not referring to an ancient race of enormous hominids, but rather to the island's prehistoric megalithic temples. Temples which, according to Maltese folklore and that of the surrounding countries, were actually built by, well, by enormous hominids. As the Maltese archaeologist Anthony Bonanno states, quote, "For centuries, the gigantic dimensions of the stone blocks used in these wonderful constructions struck the imagination of the local population, who conjured up stories of giants, sometimes even of a single female giant, going about raising these stones." End quote. To give some sense of the incredible scale of these megalithic sites, the largest and oldest, known as Gigantea, is constructed from solid stone blocks which reach up to 20 feet in height and weigh in excess of 50 tons. Most impressively, these massive structures were built around 3,600 BC, making them more than 1,000 years older than the Great Pyramids of Egypt. In fact, they're by far the oldest freestanding structures in Europe, and Gigantea is thought to be second only to Göbekli Tepe as the oldest man-made religious structure on Earth. As for the builders of these temples, there's very little known. Since many of the temples are arranged in calculated clover-like designs and align with astrological events and celestial bodies, they certainly had advanced knowledge for people living in the Stone Age. As Dr. Anton Mifsud, president of the Prehistoric Society of Malta, explains, quote, "There is no evidence that demonstrates the buildup of skills and knowledge necessary to achieve such architectural wonders. The temple builders just seemed to wake up one day with the desire and know-how to construct impossibly large structures with primitive tools." End quote. It's an enduring mystery that only seems to grow when we turn away from the temples on Malta's surface and explore their subterranean cousins, the temples that plunge downward, carved directly into the rock of the islands itself. And this brings us to the heart of most Maltese conspiracy theories, the very problematic archaeological site we call the Halshafleni Hypogeum. Constructed as early as 3,300 BC, the Halshafleni Hypogeum is a marvel of prehistoric engineering. Cut deep into the bare rock without the aid of metal tools, nor any artificial lighting other than fire, the Hypogeum boasts three massive superimposed levels linked by tunnels and riddled with dangerous traps such as deep pits thought to have contained venomous snakes. You'll find heaping hills of broken bones everywhere, alongside ritualistic red paintings on the walls. And your voice will sound different, at least in a chamber we know as the Oracle Room. The Oracle Room resonates sound at 111 Hz, what some refer to as the God frequency, due to its effect on the human brain. This is strong evidence that these Stone Age builders somehow had advanced knowledge of acoustic engineering, too. All that considered, though, the purpose of the Hypogeum is still unknown and debated. From top to bottom, this is a place of unanswered questions. Of the three levels, the lowest is the least explored. Even to professional researchers, access is heavily restricted. It still holds undiscovered passageways and rooms, and most believe that somewhere hides the entrance to a further labyrinth of caves beneath Malta. However, several unfinished chambers were found, which suggest that, at some point, the construction of the Hypogeum was abruptly halted. For what reason, we can only speculate, but since the date of its rediscovery, things have never not been suspicious. First off, you should know that the official story of the Halshafleni Hypogeum's rediscovery is riddled with issues. Most academic sources state that it was found by a group of workmen in 1902. However, two objects, a coin and a cannonball dated back to the 1700s, have since been found in the Hypogeum. During that time, the Catholic order known as the Knights of St. John were occupying Malta, so it's likely that the Vatican has known about the Hypogeum for centuries, though they never publicly reported it. Moreover, it was most certainly known about before 1902, because the Malta Mail reported in their October 11, 1844 newspaper, quote, "The discovery of some ancient catacombs recently made at Tarsian, It was not, however, pursued, but the aperture was immediately closed until the governor, Sir Patrick Stewart, had been informed of it, end quote. For unknown reason, the Hall Sulphliani Hypogeum has been purposely reburied on multiple occasions throughout the island's history, only to be rediscovered and buried once again. In fact, it was buried so well after this 1844 report that by its rediscovery in 1902, the area above and around the Hypogeum was a residential district, with many brand new homes being built there. As the official story goes, a group of workmen were digging a cistern for one of the homes when suddenly their equipment cracked through the ground, crumbling away a deep opening in the Hypogeum's ancient ceiling, and allegedly, they fell in. The exact identities of the workmen who made this find are uncertain, as are the details that followed, because whatever happened next caused the workmen to panic, fill the opening with nearby construction materials, and make a pact between them to keep the discovery a secret. The mainstream theory suggests that the workers may have been worried about delaying their construction on the building, or that they simply used the hole as a trash bin for their construction materials, unaware of its significance. However, neither of these explained why the men were so sworn to secrecy. They kept it from their friends, wives, and children, dodged questions about what had happened that day, and did whatever they could to hide the Hypogeum's existence. But no one quite understands why, 1 year later, in 1903, they changed their minds, though some speculate that whatever they witnessed inside the Hypogeum scared them enough to make a confession to their local priest, Father Emmanuel Maugry. Father Maugry was a Jesuit priest, a passionate folklorist, and an early pioneer of Maltese archaeology. In 1903, he was appointed by the Valletta Museum to lead the excavation of the Hypogeum, an opportunity that would drastically change his life, and some suspect it may have ended it, too. I'll be straight with you, Emmanuel Maugry does not have a good reputation for this excavation, which many paint as an archaeological disaster. It's not that he was an amateur. Maugry was highly respected by his peers as very capable and conscientious in his work. Even the archaeologist Dr. Temi Zamit, who eventually succeeded Maugry in the Hypogeum's excavation, gave him the highest praise in the National Museum's annual report from 1903. Quote, Father E. Maugry, whose competence is unquestionable, will undoubtedly give us a full report on the completion of the work, end quote. The problem was, he never did. As Anton Mifsud later explained, quote, his notes disappeared with his sudden death in Sfax. Efforts to retrieve them have been consistently unsuccessful, end quote. In 1907, Father Emmanuel Maugry paused his work on the excavation to rather abruptly resume his role as a Jesuit priest and depart on a mission to preach Lenten sermons in Sfax, Tunisia, the northernmost country in Africa. On Good Friday, March 29th, he'd barely made it a few days in before he suddenly died at the age of 56. And as far as my research goes, there's no documented cause of death. To be fair, it's not that odd for the Vatican to order a Jesuit priest to perform missionary work in risky places. According to the Jesuit school, Regis University, quote, the early Jesuits' missions took them to places of great unrest, human rights violations, and disease. The Jesuits have always done this work because they go where God needs them. In fact, attempts to eliminate all risk could risk eliminating the very mission of a Jesuit, end quote. So, as tragic and untimely as it might be, dying as a Jesuit missionary wasn't necessarily a surprise. Maugry definitely knew the risk he was taking going to Tunisia. However, why would he embark on an overseas mission in the midst of a large archaeological excavation? Unless, of course, the project was complete. According to the National Museum's annual report for 1906, Father Maugry did finish his work apparently, though it only covered two of the Hypogeum's three levels. Stranger yet, if he completed the excavation in 1906 with enough time to arrange a trip to Tunisia, it makes no sense why he wouldn't have handed over at least a preliminary report or an outline of the findings at some point before he left, or for that matter, a copy of his notes in their entirety. He knew the mission he was going on was risky. And then there's the question of why, or even if, Maugre brought his notes on the Hypogeum with him to Tunisia. All we know is that the entirety of his documentation disappeared when he died. Maugre was not a negligent man, so considering that he never made or left copies behind, we can only speculate what might have been in those notes, and why he took them with him on a seemingly unrelated trip. Most documentation on Father Maugre tends to end here, lamenting that, with his report lost forever, we shall never know the conclusions that Maugre reached, and what exactly he found during those 5 years excavating the Hypogeum. But the truth is, not everything was lost. Almost all resources on this mystery overlook this, but I found that it's possible to read the letters Maugre sent to foreign colleagues at the British Museum during the excavation period. And these include references to artifacts he sent off for examination, as well as insight into what Maugre actually thought about the Hypogeum and the ancient people who built it. Firstly, it's clear that Father Maugre was competent as an archaeologist, despite his post-mortem reputation. In several instances, Maugre emphasized how important it was that his workmen take the greatest care during the excavation, and how the artifacts he was sending to the British Museum must be examined by the proper experts. He was also remarkably detailed when discussing various features and artifacts contained in the Hypogeum, and was careful and reserved in his speculations. He also brought up his many concerns for the preservation of the site, so it's clear that he cared very much about it. So if all his colleagues knew this, why were there so many attempts to smear his reputation after death? Interestingly, though, he asked many questions specifically regarding the age of the site and its artifacts, and who the megalithic builders might have actually been. Remember that Emmanuel Maugre wasn't just a priest and an archaeologist, but he was a serious folklorist, too. In fact, Maugre is often likened to the Maltese version of the Brothers Grimm, as he had a keen interest in recording and preserving his country's folktales and mythology, and authored some of the most seminal works on the folklore of Malta. One legend he preserved, arguably the most ancient in Malta, happened to be the story of how the temples were built. So how would a man like Father Maugre react to evidence confirming the legends that he knew so well? And more importantly, how might others react if he tried to share such discoveries? Well, let's dive into the lore and see what we're dealing with. In this folkloric version of the temple's origin, Father Maugre records that they were built not by humans, but by a single giantess named Sansuna. In those long-forgotten days, Sansuna was one of, if not the last remaining pureblood giant on Malta, the final memory of her kinfolk, giants being Malta's original inhabitants. Sansuna lived on the Maltese island of Gozo, and often interacted with the human tribes who settled there, and even chose a human mate to reproduce with. After Sansuna gave birth to a half-giant, half-human hybrid baby, she restricted her diet to nothing but broad beans and honey, and committed to building the temple complex Gigantea, or Giantess in English. As Sansuna held her baby to her chest, she traveled to the town of Tachench, where she lifted huge stones from the quarries onto her shoulder, and sometimes her head, and carried them 2.5 miles to her construction site. There the giantess built the megalithic structure, stone by stone, alone. She wore a large apron and kept a stash of broad beans in the main pocket, and was known to snack on them as she worked. Sansuna would eat all day, sometimes shoveling beans into her mouth, and according to the legend, this diet was the source of her enormous strength, which was impressive even for a giant. In these tales, it's only specified that she built the temple as a place for the humans there to perform worship. What they were worshiping and why it was important to the giantess Sansuna is unknown. The legends assert that after Sansuna finished building Gigantea, she went on to construct all the other megalithic and subterranean temples found on the islands until she met her ultimate demise. The master storyteller, Marilyn Perringer, recounted two different ends of this folktale, based on the research conducted by Father Maugre in 1902. Quote, "One season in Malta, there was a terrible drought, and all the beans withered on their stalks, and because Sansuna could no longer eat the broad beans, she died. But there's another story about her, and it says that Sansuna was married and had two children, a boy and a girl. They were quite young, and they needed afternoon naps. She kept them with her in the mornings when she was working, but in the afternoons, they needed to rest. She would put them in a shade of groves and trees, and then go on with her work. One afternoon, she did this as usual, and she went off to carry stones to the temple sites and left the children by themselves. And that was when pirates from a neighboring island came. They were after these children because they wanted to marry them with local stock and thus increase the strength of their own people. So they stole the children away, carrying them in their boat. Sansuna went back to check on her children and found them gone, and she seemed to know what had happened. Immediately she ran to the shore and looked out, and she could see the boat. Without hesitation, she dived into the water and started swimming after them. In no time at all, she caught up to the boat and put her huge hands on the side of the boat. Those pirates were terrified. They pulled out their knives and they hacked on her hands as she grabbed the side of the boat, and they hacked at her hands until they fell from her arms. She fell backwards into the water, and it is said that she drowned. End quote. The idea that Malta was once home to giants like Sansuna is not only a very ancient tradition, but a persistent one. One of the first writers to mention Malta was the Greek poet Homer, sometime between 725 and 675 BC. In Homer's depiction, Malta, which he called by his older name of Hyperia, was the home of a race of giants known as the Phaeacians, quote, whose haughty lines mixed with gods, half human, half divine. End quote. Be careful not to confuse the Phaeacians with the historical Phoenicians who later ruled Malta. In Greek mythology, the Phaeacian giants were thought to have been chased to Malta by the one-eyed giant Cyclops, who ruled over the neighboring islands. While the Phaeacians were identified as giants, the Greeks also specifically labeled them as second generation or human-giant hybrids of the original Maltese inhabitants. Accordingly, the original Maltese were pure giants, like Sansuna, who bred with the human tribes that settled on the island. Either way, the belief that Malta was at one time ruled by giants seems to have been an almost universal consensus for centuries amongst the learned men of Europe. One important writer who certainly believed this was John Francesco Abela, the Chancellor of the Order of the Knights of St. John, who's widely recognized as the father of Maltese historiography. Like many of his colleagues at the time, Abela attributed the construction of the megaliths to, quote, a race of giants, descendants of the children of Noah, who were the first inhabitants of the Maltese islands, and whose skeletal remains turned up occasionally in Maltese soil, end quote. Abela claimed to have personally seen enormous bones and teeth the thickness of a man's finger. He even reported how, on occasion, a giant's leg bone had been used as the crossbar for a door. Meanwhile, the occasional turning up of giant bones seems to have been a fairly regular occurrence, documented many times from various sources. In the mid-1700s, for example, the respected historian and church cleric Canon Aegis de Soldanis recorded the discovery of, quote, a giant skeleton in excavating the foundations of Fort Manuel, Malta, in the time of Grand Master Manuel de Villena, about 1725, end quote. This belief in historical Maltese giants was so widespread and their bones so commonly excavated that in 1653, a giant's tooth was found on the Maltese island of Gozo and was presented as a treasure to Pope Alexander VII. This might sound intriguing, however, many of these giant bones have now vanished without a trace. But a bone on Malta does not need to be of gigantic proportions to become lost to time. No, as the archaeologist who succeeded Father Maugre found out, human remains go missing just as easily. Following Maugre's death, the Halsafleni Hypogeum project was taken over in 1907 by an archaeologist named Sir Themistocles Zimit, or Temizimit for short. Unlike Father Maugre, who tends to be more heavily criticized, Dr. Zimit's legacy remains much more highly respected, though his work wasn't without major hiccups. One of the main issues revolved around the number of skeletons he found in the Hypogeum, and the fact that this number always seems to be shrinking. This conundrum all started when Zamit's assistant, William A. Griffiths, published his 1920 report for National Geographic. Quote, "It has been estimated that the ruins contain the bones of 33,000 persons, mostly adults. Practically all were found in the greatest disorder, and there had evidently been no regular burial of a complete body." End quote. Years later, Dr. Zamit himself listed this number drastically lower at 7,000. So the only way to explain this inconsistency would be a serious miscalculation from the start, or simply put, the bones were destroyed. As Zamit wrote in his 1910 report, quote, "All the human bones found buried in red earth when the hypogeum was excavated were deposited in this cave. The bones are mostly reduced to dust for dampness, and the deep layer of soil crushed the bones and disintegrated them." End quote. To give you an idea of how many skeletons were discovered versus how many were actually retrieved, different sources state that only 7 or 11 or possibly 20 skulls were successfully taken out from the hypogeum. That's another number people can't seem to agree on. As for why the number of skulls remains continuously debated, this is because after they were transported to the Valletta Museum, they routinely went missing from the public eye. Some are still missing today, surviving only in photographs taken by Dr. Zamit as evidence of their existence. As the author Philip Coppens explained in his article, From the Other World to Another World, quote, "In recent decades, much of the bones have disappeared. As the losses are unexplained by default, a number of conspiracy theories are in circulation in Malta that argue that the museum wants these bones to disappear, suggesting they somehow are able to provide evidence against the official story about what the hypogeum is." End quote. The skulls removed from the hypogeum were not ordinary, by the way. The vast majority were elongated skulls which appear almost alien-like, similar to skulls discovered from other ancient cultures located hundreds and thousands of miles away from this isolated island, such as in Peru, China, and Bulgaria. It's unknown how this tradition came to Malta. These elongated skulls were on display in Malta's National Museum of Archaeology from the late 1920s until they were secreted away from public view in 1985, alongside many other skeletal remains from the hypogeum. If you feel like something fishy is going on, you better prepare yourself, because it turns out that the Hal Saffliani Hypogeum is not the only underground site in Malta, nor the only collection of Neolithic human bones that seem to have been dealt with in a very suspicious manner. Take, for example, the Hal Saffliani's nearby sister temple, the Santa Lucia Hypogeum. As the president of the Prehistoric Society of Malta, Dr. Anton Mifsud, frustratedly reported, quote, "In 1973, a very large quantity of human remains were discovered at the smaller hypogeum in Santa Lucia. These have never been exhibited, and their present whereabouts are unknown." End quote. For unclear reasons, the Santa Lucia hypogeum was never excavated and was almost immediately sealed shut after its discovery. Then there's the Shara Hypogeum, also known as the Shara Stone Circle, which was first discovered at the end of the 1700s, then excavated around 1820, after which it was inexplicably reburied and utterly forgotten about. For over 100 years, the only evidence of its existence were watercolor paintings made by the artist Charles Frederick de Brockdorff during the original excavation. As explained by the cultural anthropologist Mark Andrew Carpenter, quote, "Shara's location was lost until being rediscovered in 1964. This excavation revealed 220,000 bones belonging mostly to dismembered human skeletons scattered throughout the site. Much of the site remains unstudied. No radiocarbon tests have been published, and the site is not open to the public." End quote. Most modern scholars agree that conventional scholarship on the history and archaeology of Malta has been plagued with red flags, inexplicable oversights, and a culture of secrecy that seems to stretch back well over 100 years. A phrase you'll often hear from commentators is that Malta guards its secrets well. As Dr. Anton Mifsud ominously admits, quote, "Great reluctance prevails on the part of several members of the local archaeological establishment to acknowledge the true nature of our Maltese ancestors." end quote. Coming from one of the most respected scholars in this field, indeed it sounds like there might be secrets here that are actively being guarded. That said, the key almost certainly lies with the Holsoff-Lianni hypogeum, beginning with its mysterious purpose. While it's mostly assumed that the purpose of the hypogeum was as a place of ritualistic worship, the nature of those rituals and the religious beliefs of the builders are still heavily disputed. The list of possibilities ranges far and wide, from the worship of a fertility goddess to sacred snake rituals and even death cults. Without a doubt, one purpose the hypogeum definitely served was as a catacomb or ossuary. When the temple was rediscovered, one of the first things researchers found was an enormous quantity of human and animal bones mixed with burial offerings and figurines, all covered in red ochre. While it's intriguing enough as an ancient mass grave, when it comes to the hypogeum, there's still a far more unsettling possibility. As the folklorist Brian Houghton somewhat sarcastically suggests in his book, Haunted Spaces, Sacred Places, quote, "The remains were all human sacrifices to some underworld god," end quote. Houghton may have not taken this notion seriously, but when you look into the history of human sacrifice in Malta, this theory begins to bear some weight. It's hard to say whether adults were sacrificed, but we can confidently say that children were. The Oxford researcher Dr. Josephine Quinn published a paper revealing that burnt remains of infants had been found in urns beneath Malta. These were from a few thousand years after the hypogeum was built, but there's strong evidence that these practitioners were worshipping something subterranean in nature. In 2012, a Maltese stela from the 6th century BC was translated and published by the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Quote, "To the holy lord Baal Haman, a great sacrifice of nighttime, Moloch, breath for breath, blood for blood, life for life." According to the inscription, the sacrifice to Baal Haman was made at night. This confirms the chthonic underworld nature of this sacrifice. End quote. Many of those who've studied the Bible likely recognize the names of these ancient gods, Baal Haman and Moloch, and their association with this disturbing sacrificial act. But was it really just limited to children? There are some strikingly odd features of the hypogeum itself which suggests that adults may have been victims too. For example, the steps in the lowest chamber of the hypogeum were deliberately built to include a large uneven drop, intended to cripple those unaware of its presence. And it was clearly an effective trap, because in 2004, a cameraman descending those same stairs fell and broke his femur. The question is, why would the temple builders deliberately install such a grisly pitfall? Unsurprisingly, it's not the only one. As described by William A. Griffiths in his 1920 National Geographic article, quote, "There is a mysterious pit. The low stone wall is grooved to receive an upper stone, thus increasing its height. The pit is shaped like a funnel. After sloping downward and inward, the pit widens considerably and is sufficiently deep to prevent even a tall man from climbing out," end quote. So here we have a stone funnel that a large man could be cast into but could not escape from. Not the sort of thing you find in many religious buildings. Finally, in light of how many skeletons seem to have disappeared over the years, we should consider the few details shared about the skeletons that were actually examined. One of the first things recorded by the archaeologist Dr. Temi Zamit and his contemporaries was the sheer lack of intact skeletons within the mass graves. With almost no exception, all the bones were disjointed and separated, almost as if they'd been dismembered or torn apart, then thrown away indiscriminately into these massive piles. In his report from 1910, Zamit also mentions that, quote, "The bones of the dead were placed after having been deprived of their flesh," end quote. While there's solid evidence of this, the idea that the bones were stripped of their flesh creates a bit of a puzzle. Scientists agree that if the hypogeum contained such high amounts of decomposing meat, the emissions released over time would have noticeably damaged the temple's paintings. However, that's not the case. So either the stripped flesh was taken out of the hypogeum for whatever reason, or if it remained in the temple, it must have been consumed. Finally, we need to turn toward the one and only complete skeleton ever found in the Hypogeum. As Dr. Anton Mifsud reported, quote, "The one intact human skeleton that was discovered in room 22 showed no evidence of ritual burial, but rather the characteristic features of a severely emotional death." Any student of forensic medicine will confirm this through the specifically contorted and flexed wrists and fingers of the right hand, end quote. While this is just one skeleton, considering the disturbing broken state of the rest of the bodies, it seems highly likely that these ancient victims suffered very much, whether as sacrifices to the spiritual world, or perhaps live offerings for something very hungry living underground. And considering the number of elaborate traps, it seems that these may have been unsuspecting people captured by some cult on the island who deliberately hid the true purpose of the Hypogeum. And now we have to wonder, if the myth of the Maltese giants could be true, maybe the ancients lied about the race of giants dying out. What if they made their new home underground? It might sound fantastical, but that would be something worth covering up. In August of 1940, an article published in the National Geographic magazine by Richard Walter, titled "Wanderers Awheel in Malta," recounted a tragedy that allegedly occurred in the lowest level of the Halsafleni Hypogeum. Quote, "Years ago, one could walk underground from one end of Malta to the other, but all entrances were closed by the government because of a tragedy. On a sightseeing trip comparable to a nature study tour in our own schools, a number of elementary school children and their teachers descended into the tunneled maze and did not return. For weeks, mothers declared that they had heard wailing and screaming from underground, but numerous excavations and searching parties brought no trace of the lost souls. After 3 weeks, they were finally given up for dead." End quote. What's intriguing about this story is the fact that it was published by National Geographic, which is typically regarded as a reliable educational and historical source. The main problem is that this National Geographic article doesn't cite a source for the missing children's story, and this is because the author, Richard Walter, heard it directly from multiple Maltese locals he'd befriended. So it seems as if the story was common knowledge in Malta at the time. But without evidence, it's hard to say whether it's an urban legend or if it actually happened. Most researchers agree that if the incident did in fact take place, then it should be possible to find evidence of what would have been a major news story by examining archives from that time period. In a National Geographic documentary investigating the incident, the witchcraft historian Ronald Hutton, alongside a representative from the National Library, examined hundreds of newspapers and came back with nothing. Though, as the research project Shades of Malta points out, this was because they were searching in the wrong place. Quote, "Hutton searched around 1940, apparently not having or not using the time frame of the mid-1930s. End quote. Considering that the article was published in 1940 and describes the incident as having already taken place and acted upon by the government, it would have almost certainly been in the 1930s. Why a respected historian and a National Library representative would make such an obvious mistake, your guess is as good as mine. Regardless, the mystery goes even deeper, because the missing children are again mentioned in our final story, as are the Inner Earth Giants of Malta themselves. In the mid-1930s, a British woman by the name of Constance Lewis Jessop visited the Halsafleni Hypogeum with her friends on a guided tour, and what followed has since become one of Malta's most infamous mysteries. Jessop's story was published in the form of two documents, a 1960 article titled "The Reality of the Cavern World," published by Borderland Sciences, and a 1961 first-hand account titled "Malta, Entrance to the Cavern World," printed in the Journal of Borderland Research. And before we get into it, it's worth noting that in 2021, the National Archives of Malta uncovered a British passport from 1937 belonging to Constance Lewis Jessop, with Malta noted as her place of residence, which seems to confirm her presence on the island at the time of these alleged events. So, without further ado, on a particularly hot afternoon in the mid-1930s, Jessop and her friends decided it would be cool to descend deep underground, so they drove to the entrance of the Halsafleni Hypogeum and found a guide to take them in. Quote, The entrance itself smelt damp and moldy, but inside the cave there was not a trace of mustiness. Joe, the guide, gave each of us a lighted candle. One by one, we bent down low to walk through a narrow passage, end quote. The group proceeded to tour through three areas of the hypogeum, each deeper than the last. First, the oracle room, where their voices became powerfully magnified. Then another chamber with an altar and what appeared to be stone beds, each only 4 feet long. Finally, in the deepest Tor-sanctioned chamber, the walls were cut open with slits, through which Jessup peered through and saw piles of skeletons. Their guide explained that one side was some sort of burial ground, and the other side was a prison, locked shut by a 3-foot-thick stone door. Cool. This is the end of the tour, Joe, the guide, said. We must now turn and retrace our steps. What's down there? I asked him, for on turning I noticed another opening off one of the walls. Go there at your own risk, he replied, and you won't go far, end quote. A bit of an ominous answer, but the ever-curious Miss Jessup wasn't deterred. She felt strongly about exploring further, so she adjusted the long sash around her dress to act as a safety rope and handed the long end of the sash to her friend. Three of her friends agreed to go with her, while the other two waited with the guide. Lighting their way with only half-burnt candles, Jessup and her three friends forged onward, with Jessup in the lead. Quote, groping and laughing our way along, I came out first onto a ledge pathway about 2 feet wide, with a sheer drop about 50 feet or more. I took a step forward. The person behind me, still holding onto my sash, had not yet emerged from the passage. Thinking it was quite a drop and perhaps I should not go any further without the guide, I held up my candle. There, across the cave, from an opening deep below me, emerged 20 persons of giant stature. In single file, they walked along a narrow ledge. Their height I judged to be about 20 or 25 feet, since their heads came about halfway up the opposite wall. They walked very slowly, taking long strides. Then they all stopped, turned and raised their heads in my direction. All simultaneously raised their arms and, with their hands, beckoned me. The movement was something like snatching or feeling for something, as the palms of their hands were face down. Terror rooted me to the spot. Go on, we're all getting stuck in the passage. My friend jerked at my sash. What's the matter? My candle was in my right hand. I put my left hand on the wall to steady me, and stopped again. My hand wasn't on cold rock, but on something soft and wet. As it moved, a strong gust of wind came from nowhere and blew out my candle. Go back, I yelled to the others. Go back and guide me back by my sash. My candle has gone out and I cannot see. In utter panic, I backed into the narrow little passageway and forced the others back too, until we had backed into the large room where Joe and my friends were waiting. Well, did you see anything? Asked one of them. No, I quickly replied. There was a draft in there that blew my candle out. Let's go, said Joe, the guide. I looked up at him. Our eyes met. I knew that at one time he had seen what I had seen. There was an expression of caution in his eyes, adding to my reluctance to tell anyone. I decided not to, end quote. After this event and having made their way out from the hypogeum and back to the surface world, Joe, their guide, pulled Jessup aside from her friends to speak with her privately, and this is what he said to her. Quote, if you really are interested in exploring further, it would be wise to join a group. There is a school teacher who is going to take a party exploring soon, end quote. Jessup, of course, was as deeply intrigued as she was disturbed by what she'd seen. She gave Joe her address and asked him to get her in touch with the school teacher. However, as Jessup recounts, she never heard anything from them after. Several years passed, and one day Lewis Jessup received a call from one of her friends who joined her on the tour. The year was 1940, and the friend had just read the National Geographic article about the disappearance of the 30 school children. Quote, I say, Lewis, remember that tunnel you wanted to explore? The school children apparently got as far as we did. They were roped together and the end of the rope was tied to the opening of the cave. As the last student turned the corner where your candle blew out, the rope was clean cut, and none of the party was found, because the walls caved in, end quote. This rather shocking news prompted Jessup to travel with her sister back to Malta and visit the Hypogeum once more to investigate. This time around, their guide was different, and when they reached the lowest tour sanctioned level of the temple, the tunnel entrance she'd gone through before had been completely boarded up. Quote, "Wasn't it here that the schoolmaster and the 30 students got trapped?" I asked the guide. "Perhaps," he replied, with a non-committal shrug of the shoulders, and refused to say anything more. "You cannot get a thing out of the Maltese when they don't want to talk." "You are new here, aren't you?" I asked him. "Where's Joe, the guide who was here before?" "I don't know any Joe," he shook his head. "I alone have been showing people around this catacomb for years." "Who was this guide, and why did Joe disappear after we left Halsafleni that first time?" End quote. Besides the passport showing that Constance Lewis Jessup was indeed in Malta in the 1930s, there's other evidence that Jessup's account is authentic. In 1960, Jessup shared her story with the Borderland Sciences researcher Riley Crabb. In Crabb's report, he describes his initial impression of Jessup and her account beneath Malta. Quote, "We spent 2 days with Lewis Jessup during our eastern trip in April 1960 and found her a charming hostess, cosmopolitan as a much-traveled Englishwoman can be, and a student of the borderland. Jessup has a level-headed, level-eyed way of looking at life and people, which is very refreshing. Nevertheless, I found her Malta story difficult to believe, until Mrs. Crabb and I returned home and I had a chance to look up Malta at the San Diego Library." End quote. There in the library, Riley Crabb was able to confirm the accuracy of Jessup's descriptions of the site's layout and main features, including the swirl-like painted decorations and a brief outline of the Oracle Room's appearance and purpose. In her meeting with Crabb, Jessup also provided intriguing additional details of the encounter, such as her observation that the Inner Earth giants were covered in a profusion of white hair. Quote, "Miss Jessup found the giants of the cave hard to describe because their shaggy covering seemed to be like long white hair, combed downward and shaggy looking. Their heads were unusually elongated at the chin and top, with large features, and the hair on their heads fell about the shoulders like a draped monk's cowl." End quote. Mammals living permanently in such a dark environment would certainly experience a loss of hair pigmentation, so the long white hair makes sense in terms of animal biology and morphology. Moreover, in Jessup's original account, she described the Inner Earth giants as moving in slow strides, which might seem a bit counterintuitive for long-legged creatures who you'd think would be able to cover distance quickly, unless there's a good reason for them to be moving slowly. Blindness is a feature found in many subterranean species, and Jessup described snatching or feeling hand gestures toward her as soon as the giants noticed her presence, which sounds a lot like the actions of creatures with restricted vision from generations of living underground. Finally, Jessup mentioned to Crabb that the giants had an elongated skull. This could explain why the ancient people of Malta artificially deformed their own skulls in a similar manner, in the case that they might have seen these creatures as gods. As for the giants themselves, having both an elongated chin and cranium suggests the presence of a sagittal crest, such as that found in gorillas, which is useful for supporting a huge jaw to chew through tough raw food and bones. So you can guess what their diet might have been. Riley Crabb gives his frank opinion, quote, "Archaeologists believe that catacombs like Halsafleni were burial tombs. I rather think that it was a cavern restaurant for the degenerate, undersized humans who were forced into the caves thousands of years ago. In this experience of Lewis Jessup's, and in the Halsafleni material in the National Geographics, we do have some of the best factual support of the Shaver mystery your editor has yet seen. There are many facts which back up Richard Shaver's contention that the Darrows, the evil cavern dwellers, are cannibals and enjoy eating human flesh," end quote. Here, Riley Crabb draws a direct connection to another infamous Inner Earth mystery, which I covered in Episode 2, the Shaver Mystery. In the early 1940s, the writer Richard Shaver claimed to have been kidnapped and held prisoner by an Inner Earth race of giants called the Darrow, and one of the main details Shaver emphasized was that these giants were sadistic creatures whose diet consisted of humans from the surface. All that said, there's obviously a lot of speculation here, but Jessup's account of the third lowest level being boarded up is absolutely true. Even today, all tours are restricted to only the first two levels, which wasn't the case until after the 1930s, and after the alleged events of Jessup's encounter with giants and the later case of the school children going missing. Regarding the disappearance of the children, Crabb ponders, quote, why the British government, powerful as it is, didn't organize an expedition and go in there in great force. Bureaucratic officials are not notoriously brave. In this case, it would be easier to close the file with the official statement that the walls had caved in and walling off the area, not an unusual procedure for authorities in a situation beyond their control. End quote. Over the decades, though, tour regulations of the Hypogeum have indeed become more and more unusual, to the extent that most tourists find it genuinely bizarre. For example, visitors must always have an assigned tour guide and stay within a few feet of them at all times. Visitors are not allowed to bring anything into the Hypogeum. No cameras, no phones. Everything must be left in a locker before entering. And during the tour, it's required for everyone to stay absolutely silent at all times, including the guide. It surely makes you wonder, are we trying to avoid drawing something's attention? For all you watching, let me know in the comments whether or not you believe Jessup or the story of the missing children. And if you have any other information on these mysteries, please do share. Thank you for watching. If you enjoyed this episode and haven't seen Inner Earth Conspiracy Theories number 6, we dive deep into the hidden world beneath the Grand Canyon and possibly the greatest cover-up in American history. Or if you're in the mood to binge all my Inner Earth stories in one go, check out my curated playlist designed to transport you to the subterranean realm, linked in the description. Thank you to my patrons. Your generosity helps fund my research and makes this series possible, so huge shout out to you all. It really means the world to me. And if you're watching and would like to join in, I've got links in the description to pledge monthly or make a one-time donation, and 100% goes back into these videos. I'm Mr. Mythos. Never stop seeking. I'll see you in the next one. Peace.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. We're so glad that you could be with us once again for Stories and Myths. I am your host, Craig Von Buzik, and I am happy to be joined this evening by another co-host. And now he didn't put his last name down below in the name place, but by looking at him, you probably could tell that this is my other son, David Von Buzik. And I am so happy that David is able to join me as co-host tonight. First of all, hello, David. How are you?
Doing great, Dr. Von Buzik. How are you doing today?
Oh, you could just say dad. That would be just fine as well.
Yeah, that seems better.
Well, good, good. I'm so glad that you could join with us. And John C. Farrell, who is the normal co-host, had some family things arise, and he was not able to be with us this week. He said to say hello to everyone in the audience, but he will hopefully be back with us next week. But that gives me the opportunity to introduce another member of the family, because as you know, Aaron, your older brother, was the co-host last week, and but I'm kind of happy that you're here this week, because the subject matter is something that you and I both enjoy, and that is we're going to be talking about the Revolutionary War. We want to say hello to Kelly Williams Duncan, who writes in that it's clear that he belongs to you. Laugh out loud. We almost look like twins, so except I've got the gray hair. This is what I looked like in 1989.
See, that doesn't really track because I don't have a perm.
Well, I didn't have a perm in 89. My perms stopped in the early 80s, so happily so. Well, actually, I think, no, that's not true. I had a wave in 88. But that was the last one, my last wave. But at any rate, we're going to talk tonight about the Revolutionary War, the American Revolution. But before we do, tell us a little bit about you, what you're doing, and you have a keen interest in history as well.
That's right. Right now, I am working for Regent University. I work as an admissions evaluator, just helping students through the enrollment process, which is a really great it's a really great thing to do. I feel like I'm really helping people along their way, getting moved forward. But yeah, no, I've had a an interest in history for as long as I can remember. Now, a lot of that does come from the musical 1776, and
which
just going
is
around
what we're going to talk about tonight. Exactly.
Exactly. And then also, we've been to so many colonial and historic sites around the country. I honestly couldn't even count them if I tried.
Yes, it has been something that has been a family. I guess you would say it's one of the things that we love to do. And maybe it's because I love to do it and you guys got dragged along, but I think some of that passed down to you as an interest as well.
Yeah, that's true. I've definitely been to Colonial Williamsburg without you, so.
Oh.
It's like it's not just you. It's just you planted that seed there.
Well, that's good. So thinking back over the years, what were some of the highlights of the historical places that we visited that made an impact on you? Obviously, Colonial Williamsburg is one.
Colonial Williamsburg, you know, with living in Virginia, you also do Jamestown, New Yorktown. Definitely the Civil War battle sites are up there, especially like Gettysburg, just kind of being up there and seeing that and just looking back on like the toll that that took. It's just interesting. And then for a more lighthearted side of things, Colonial Williamsburg, like I said, it's like stepping into history. It's not something that a lot of people who aren't familiar with it get to do. And so that's something that I really appreciate, the fact that they've preserved it the way they have. And even like I believe it was the governor's mansion that they had, that they found blueprints and rebuilt it like
yeah,
to the spec.
It had been
that.
Destroyed.
Exactly. And so it's not only preserving the old history, but it's updating and retaining it, maintaining like the, I guess, character educators. Is that the right, term that they use?
Interpreters.
Yeah, the interpreters, who, maintain those like historical techniques for like blacksmithing, all the different things that they craft and create down there. And it's
right. They actually do they make the things that they're working on and then mm-hmm. they sell them in the bookstores.
Yeah.
Which I think is awesome.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, well, excellent. Very good. Well, you know, you and I both have a love for 1776, and I recently was a keynote speaker at the Blue Ridge Christian Writers Conference, and I shared a little bit of the debate scene between John Adams and John Dickinson. Now, do you remember any of that debate scene?
Like the specific words of it or
yeah.
not offhand.
Well,
that's actually one I've been wanting to rewatch.
How about if I give you a little snippet?
Oh yeah, go for it.
Because I played Dickinson, as I recall, when I was in ninth mm-hmm. grade. And so the debate scene is they're debating whether or not to break free from Great Britain and declare their independence. So John Dickinson opens up by saying, "Well, sir, you've gotten your way at last. The matter can now be discussed. I confess I'm somewhat relieved. I have a question that I've been fairly itching to ask you, sir. Why?" And you would answer,
"Why what, Mr. Dickinson?"
"Why independence, Mr. Adams?" "For the obvious reason," John Adams answers, "that our continued association with Great Britain has grown intolerable." And Dickens says,
"Intolerable? To whom? To you?"
"Then I suggest you sever your ties immediately, but please be kind enough to leave the rest of us where we are. We won't go into too much more than that, but I love, it comes down to the point where they're almost ready to come to blows."
They do come to blows. They're hitting each other with canes by the end of the scene.
Right. Well, they are almost ready to start hitting each other with canes. And Dickinson says, now, are these the acts of Englishmen? And John Adams answers,
no, sir. Americans.
Not Englishmen, Dickinson. Americans.
Americans.
Which leads us, which will transition from there, into our first question, which is?
So our first question is going to be, what was the cause of the American Revolution?
Well, there had been decades and decades of fighting between the French and the British and the Spanish, who were the three most powerful empires. Portugal was a lesser power, but still a power at that time. And so over the years, they fought for control of the lands all around the world as their navies would go out into the world. And so we know that the Spanish actually were the first to establish a colony in North America. And the oldest part of that is still intact in Florida at St. Augustine. And then almost around the same time, ironically, they were also establishing a fort and a church in New Mexico. And so the Spanish had the first foothold, and then the French and the British came in, and each one laid claim to a certain amount of land. Now, that didn't mean anything other than that they were saying that, well, you know, we're gonna claim this, and if you want to try and claim it, you're going to have to fight us for it. And we want to just say real quick, hello. My sister, Aaron Von Buzik's staff, says hi again to the other Von Buzik. So we say hello to her. So that's what happened, is that each of these empires started to stake out their claim. So the French took the interior of what is now the United States and then took a large swath of what is now Canada. And the British took the eastern seaboard all the way down to Florida, which obviously was Spanish, and started to move in there, both in what is now the United States and also up into what is now Canada. And so that was where everybody kind of staked their claims. Well, in the meantime, and in the midst of all of this, there were the Native Americans that were living on these lands. And in some cases, the European powers would give them money or some sort of a trade for land. Other cases, they would just fight for it and they would take it. Although I know that the English really did try to be fair in many cases, and also the French. But in the end, the French kind of gained the hearts of the Native Americans. And so the British and the French had been fighting in Europe, and that spilled over into the New World as they were trying to establish where the boundary lines would be. And so the French convinced the Native Americans to fight on their behalf, and they basically said, we're going to give you your land. We're not going to mess with it like the English have. So if you fight with us, you know, everything will be hunky-dory. So there was a major war that we call the French and Indian War, that took place in the 1750s. In the end, that war actually spread all over the world. It was really a world war 200 years before what we had in the 20th century. So in the 18th century, there was this world war between the French and the British that went on for decades. And the estimates are that more than 1 million people died in those battles over all those years, which is hard to fathom that back then that many people could be killed in that kind of a war, but that's what happened. It ended up costing the British so much. It was tremendous cost in lives, in materials, and in money. But in the end, the British won, and they defeated the French, and they pushed the French primarily out of Canada and took over most of Canada and then continued with the colonies on the east coast of what is now the United States. Well, the cost of this was so exorbitant that it had emptied the coffers in Great Britain. And so King George, who was a little bit nuts. He was an unbalanced person. He was highly intelligent, but he was also highly unbalanced. And so he pushed Parliament to levy what were called different stamp acts upon the colonies. And these were taxes. So they would put a stamp onto a barrel of wheat or flour. They would put a stamp onto a barrel of tobacco or whatever it might be. And every time that that went in or out of a port, the colonists had to pay taxes on this. And to them, these were very high taxes, but they were willing to pay for, because they understood that, well, this gives us protection. We have protection of the most powerful empire in the world, the most powerful army in the world. It continues trade, and that's a good thing. So at first, they kind of put up with it, but the taxes kept getting more and more. They kept getting higher and higher. And then what really bothered the colonists here in America, the American British colonists, was that they had no representation to determine what taxes would be levied upon them. All of those taxes were passed by the Parliament in Great Britain. And so these colonists, they were told that they were English citizens, but they didn't have true representative government. Now, they did have it on the local and the colonial level, but they didn't have it on the federal level. And that is where they started to chafe against what was happening. And it got worse and worse. And unfortunately, instead of negotiating and trying to find some sort of a settlement with the most prosperous colony that England had by far. I mean, it was so much bigger than England, and it produced so much more raw materials. It's almost crazy that the British allowed what happened to happen. But it was, I think a lot of it had to do with King George and his erratic behavior, and also just pride. I think that the Parliament said, well, we're the Parliament, you're not, we're in charge, and so we're going to, you know, pass these laws. And they didn't realize the will of the people of America, because the American colonists by this point had been on the continent for 150 years, more than 150 years.
Generations of people having lived, their families lived here, their parents, their grandparents.
Exactly.
This is their turf, and someone else is basically just saying, you're going to pay this. I do kind of wonder how things may have gone different if they had had representation.
You might be speaking with a British accent right now. That kind of went Irish a little bit there. You're better at the accents than I am.
But no, it's it is kind of interesting. I do wonder if it's like that out of sight, out of mind mentality that the British, like actual in England people had, that they're like, oh yeah, no, like it doesn't even come into their mind how massive America is, because they're just focused on where what they can see and what's immediately impacting them.
I think that there's a lot of truth to what you're saying, David, but I also think that colonialism as a system was an arrogant, obnoxious system.
Oh, yeah. And you can't come up with the catchphrase, the sun never sets on the British Empire, when you're about the size of New Jersey, I want to say.
What was that? Oh, you mean the England, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what a comparable thing, but it would be compared to one of our states in the United States. And it was ruling an empire that went all the way around the world, like you said. Mm-hmm. They're literally, under Victoria, it got to the point where the sun never set on the British Empire, which is hard to even fathom right now. Yeah. So in the end, the Americans started to rebel. They started to not pay the tax. They started to blockade British military ships. And then when the British military started to move in response, especially in Massachusetts and in Boston specifically, the militias started to be raised all across the country to protect the different areas against the British. And so it was inevitable that there would be eventually a clash. And so then the British started to raid these arms depots and the places where they were keeping their gunpowder, where the militias were keeping their gunpowder, basically trying to disarm them. And that's why the Founding Fathers put in such a strong Second Amendment to protect the right of citizens to bear arms, to protect themselves both personally, but also against a tyrannical government, which is why I am a strong and never-ending proponent of the Second Amendment, because no government should be in a place where it does not have a healthy fear of their people, meaning that they respect the fact that the people are not just going to be bowled over. And that's where tyranny happens. When a government has no respect for its own people, then tyranny takes place. And that's what was happening. And so in order to battle this, the Sons of Liberty or the Patriots, there's a reason why New England named their football team the Patriots, because they were naming them after these patriotic colonials in Boston who stood up against the British troops in a very bold way, knowing that they could lose their lives. Mm-hmm. And so one of the major moves was what was called the Boston Tea Party, where people like Samuel Adams, which was John Adams' cousin, and other patriots, Paul Revere and others, they went on to British ships and they threw British tea into the ocean, into the bay, and as a protest against the British. Well, that caused a clampdown of the British, and tempers rose and rose until one day the militia and just regular people came to a screaming match with a regiment of British soldiers, and the soldiers felt fearful for their lives. And unfortunately, they opened fire and killed several of the colonials, and that was called the Boston Massacre. And interestingly, the person who defended those troops was none other than John Adams.
It's an interesting position to be in, someone who believes that your country should be independent, but is also that dedicated to the law and to justice, that it's like, I believe that these people were in the right and defending people who politically you're against, but morally you agree.
John Adams
with their
would
action.
Not have said he believes totally that they're in the right, but he believed that they had the right to a fair trial. Mm-hmm. And they had a right to have their cause brought out in front of a jury of their peers. Mm-hmm. However, John Adams was greatly conflicted, because he was more and more seeing that continued association with Great Britain had grown intolerable. And so that is how it all began. And then not long after that, the sister colonies decided that they needed to get together to discuss what was going on. And so they sent the best and the brightest of the men at that time, because women were not involved in politics and did not have the vote at that time. And so the best of the brightest of the men gathered in Philadelphia for the First Continental Congress. And one of the first things that they did in 1775 was to appoint George Washington, who had been an officer in the British government or in the British army years before and had fought in the French and Indian War. They appointed him to be general in chief over the army, the Continental Army. Many in the Congress at that point in 1775 merely did this as a protection, but they were not interested in independence. Mm-hmm. They were looking to put out an olive branch. They were wanting to ask King George for reconciliation. But unfortunately, the British government came down very hard, especially in Connecticut and Massachusetts and in New England and then down into New York on the colonials. And many in the country who had just the year before thought there's no way that we'll ever leave our association with Great Britain. As Great Britain became more and more heavy-handed, people started to have a change of heart. even though from the standpoint of the colonials, there did not look like there would be much hope for independence, but they were going to fight for it anyway. And their overall hope was that they would have the intervention of maybe Spain or France, which is over time, many, many years went by where where George Washington would hit and run. And so that was how the war began. Just answering, Kelly Williams Duncan writes, "Don't tell Abigail Adams women weren't involved in government and politics." That is true, but it was an unofficial capacity. Mm-hmm. With the official capacity, it was only men. But Abigail Adams, who I have the greatest respect for, and had women been involved, she probably would have been our first woman president. She was a genius. Mm-hmm. And she created a lineage of Adams geniuses, her own son becoming president just like her husband, John Quincy Adams. So I have the greatest respect for Abigail Adams as well. Mm-hmm. So what's the next question?
All right. So next up, if Congress voted in favor of independence on July 2nd, 1776, then why do we celebrate the birth of the nation on July 4th?
Do you know the answer to this?
I do actually know the answer to this.
Well, then I would like to hear you answer this question.
So July 2nd is when they had voted, but they hadn't actually finished signing everybody's name to it. So while the vote was in, they hadn't all attached their name to it. And so basically anyone who is going to be voting for this needs to attach their name to it. You know, if we're all going to be hung, let's be hung together.
Right. What did Franklin said? Unless we hang together, we will surely hang separately.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Adams argued probably most of his life, or a good part of his life, that the date of independence should have been July the 2nd, because mm-hmm. that is when Congress voted for the passage. And it was passed by the vote. But as you said, it wasn't officially ratified until the majority of Congress signed their name. Now, there were still people, it took them a while because they were not there in Philadelphia and they had mm-hmm. to get back to Philadelphia and sign it. So there were some who didn't sign it, but the vast majority of Congress signed the Declaration on July the 4th. And that mm-hmm. is why we celebrate it to this day. Now, why did John Hancock do what he did?
He wanted King George to be able to see it without his spectacles.
So what is it that he did? That he did?
John Hancock, and this is where the phrase place here, John Hancock, decided to sign the biggest signature out of everyone on the document. He put his name very large, very prominent in the center of the document. Well, the center of the signing area of the document at the top.
Very good. Excellent. Boy, I am impressed with your knowledge.
Oh, yeah. I've seen National Treasure. I know.
You're quite the historian. Very good. All right. What's next?
All right. So next, we've got John Quincy Adams declared during the armistice cause before the Supreme Court, "If it means civil war, then let it come. It may be the final battle of the American Revolution." Why did Lincoln call the Civil War a new birth of freedom?
Well, it was during the, just to clarify, the Amistad Supreme Court discussion. And if you ever watch the movie Amistad, you'll know what we're talking about. And I highly recommend, that is a very accurate film about what happened to the Amistad Africans in their trying to break free. They were illegally taken as slaves after the slave trade had been overturned and made illegal. And that was pushed through, as we've talked on this program before, by William Wilberforce in Great Britain. And so the nations of the Atlantic all agreed that they would stop the Atlantic slave trade. Now, there were still nations like the United States and several Caribbean island nations that still had slavery. But slavery had pretty much been done away with in Europe. Sadly, it was still being held for many, many years in Africa. and it was multiracial slavery in Africa. So in North Africa, the Muslim raiders would attack a ship on the Mediterranean or on the Atlantic. And these were called the Berbers and Barbers. And it was called Barbary Coast. And so they would attack. And if they won the battle, they would take all of the sailors and they would become slaves. And many of those slaves were slaves for the rest of their lives in Africa. This was also true in Turkey. So John Smith, who we know from Jamestown, you had mentioned Jamestown before, you know, John Smith and Pocahontas. Well, John Smith had been fighting in a crusade in Eastern Europe, where the Christian armies of Western Europe were fighting the Muslim armies of Eastern Europe, just outside of Austria and Vienna. They actually were very close to the gates of Vienna, and there was a possibility that Vienna and or Austria would have been a Muslim nation. And so the Christian armies pushed the Muslims back into Turkey, which is, you know, still in Europe, but it was, you know, a Muslim nation primarily. And during those battles, John Smith, Captain John Smith, was taken prisoner by the Turks, and he was turned into a slave. And so John Smith could have lived his whole life as a slave in Turkey. But one day he was out hoeing some fields, and the overseer was not paying attention. And you don't want to do that with a military person. You want to be, you know, fully paying attention. And John Smith took his hoe and crushed the back of the guy's skull and took the keys. And we don't know exactly the route that he took, but it's believed that he went down through probably the Red Sea, got on a ship there. Yeah.
Just so you know, your video seems to be frozen.
Oh, is it? Am I back yet?
No, you've been frozen for a little while now. I've been waiting for it to circle back around. I don't know if you can refresh that.
Yeah, I don't know that I can. So we'll just hope that it comes back up here.
Here, if you try turning off your camera and turning it back on again, that may do it.
All right, let's try. Okay, am I back? Oh, I lost you, David. David, come on back in if you would. While David is coming back into the room, let me just finish up what I had been saying. And that was that, so John Smith got a boat somewhere and he came. So here's David again. Hello. Yeah. Daniel Wilbur. Hello to Daniel Wilbur. My buddy from grade school in Erie, Pennsylvania is with us. And he said that, I'm not frozen. Kelly says I'm not frozen. Julie says I'm not frozen. So I'm just going to say I'm not frozen. Yeah. So at any rate, so John Smith got a boat, went around Africa, came back up to England, and almost immediately was asked to be a part of the Virginia Company, went across the Atlantic, and the rest is history. But he had been a slave. And so slavery had taken place in a lot of the Muslim countries, in Turkey, in the Middle East, in Africa, but slowly over the years, it had been eradicated, but it was still going strong in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so in the Amistad case, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court because the government under Martin Van Buren had said that they were actual slaves in, I think, in Cuba, and the but the people in the north, in Connecticut, I believe, where they came in, they had said no, that these were Africans who were taken illegally. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they were able to convince John Quincy Adams, who by this time was an old man, close to death. But John Quincy Adams, like his father, had been a very strong proponent of abolition. But they were both politicians, too, so they had to walk carefully in those times. Mm-hmm. But Adams argued the case before the Supreme Court. And at the end of his argument, he said, listen, if this whole case brings us to civil war, then let it come. And may it be finally the final battle of the American Revolution. And many people, including Abraham Lincoln, and actually people on both the North and the South in the Civil War, believed that it was a second independence war, especially in the South. They called it their own second war of independence. Mm-hmm. And their patron saint was George Washington, a great Virginian. Mm-hmm. But Lincoln, he didn't necessarily call it a war of independence, but he did call it he believed it was the last and final battle of the war of independence, in that it was going to give what he called in the Gettysburg Address a new birth of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had new births of freedom throughout our history. So the Civil War was a new birth of freedom for black people and slaves, where they were given their freedom. Now, they went through another 80 to 100 years of Jim Crow racism after that. And there was a great struggle, and there continues to be for all of us a great struggle with regard to race in our country. But it was, as far as the law was concerned, it was a birth of freedom.
You. If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays? For Voices on the Wind, with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people on the fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.